On this episode of Mechs and Men, we say goodbye to Trelwan and hello to Frithandi. Hello, and welcome back. This is Of Mechs and Men. I am Kanan Hill. I am joined, as usual, by my two friends, Brent.
It's me, Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
Very good. How are we doing, boys?
We're doing great, because this week we finally get to dive into Mercenary Star by William H. Keith Jr. This week we'll be covering chapters 1-7. So we won't take up any more time. We're going to get right into it.
So, a prologue, much like the first one, if you recall. It's also just like the first one. Well, at the end, you realize it is an excerpt from like a text. Anyway, it provides a short description of the terror and majesty of a battle mech, you know, and it gives a little bit about how anyone, you know, infantry is only in like acts of desperation would infantry go like head to head with a battle mech, which is it's exactly what we saw in Decision at Thunder Rift, which is to say an act of desperation. Oh, and of course, then you get the juicy bit, which is it gives a little backstory. It introduces Frithandi, right? Here we are. We made it. Well, not quite yet, but it gives you a little backstory on Frithandi, which is that in 3016, this planet changed hands. It was originally in the auspices of House Steiner, the Lyrian Commonwealth. It's right there on the border, right? It's one of those border worlds. It's always changing hands and whatnot. But the Steiner defenders were defeated by House Kurita. Lord Kurita claimed sovereignty over the seemingly unexceptional Steiner world of Frithandi. It's in the Tamar Pact region. And then it gives you a little bit, you know, until that time, Frithandi, it was so nice, it's so pretty, it's so chill. Basically, it's like Frithandi was chill for a long time. And now, you know, since the Combine came, it's, you know, it hasn't been as chill as it used to be. And then, of course, at the end, you find out that this is an excerpt from Shapers of Men and Destiny by Janice Taylor, Avalon Free Press, written in 3031. Isn't that funny? What do you think? Good prologue?
I have two things to say before Aaron says his bit. One, I think this sets us up really good for the peculiar opening to this book in showing like how desperate these people are, and also a correction for the record historically, which is this planet originally belonged to Rosselhog, and that predates the Star League. That is all.
Thanks.
That's true.
What a good correction. We can all sleep better.
The Rosselhogians will.
So, in regards to the prologue, though, I like the first book's prologue better. I really think, like, when we talked about it, like, if you go back to our first episode and you listen to us talk about that prologue and how much, like, it sums up Battletech as a whole. It not only talks about the mechs, it talks about the greater. And I feel like this one just kind of got a little too into the nitty-grittiness of, like, talking about Frithandi and all that.
But that's what I think it's setting up, though. In its defense here, you know, that prologue was perfect for introducing us to Battletech, but we've had first Battletech. This is second Battletech.
And in terms of, I think we could have had, if I was going through this with my preference here, I probably would have talked about the life of a mercenary in the Battletech world
here. You know what?
Because we do hop into that here in just a minute, and I feel like that transition can be a little jarring, especially because we're going to talk about Frithandi, and that doesn't come up. It's going to come up in today's episode, but
it comes up immediately. I think you're misremembering the chapter.
No. Chapter one, we do talk about it, but
immediately. And the contents of this prologue immediately come into play, in which we have, not to get too ahead of ourselves, a child shooting at a 75 ton battle mech with a small arm hunting rifle.
And I will say, when we do get back to this, because we don't need to talk about this so long on the prologue,
right?
But the final line of it, then House Karita descended with its iron mailed fist, and life on Verthandi will never be the same. I do like that closing line. It does set the tone. It does transition to what you're talking about really well.
Admittedly, I agree. I think if we got a little bit into the mercenary life, I think that would have been good. But I do like this little bit of Verthandi, and I do like that it sets up that what's going on here is now become dire.
Yeah.
Nobody here is having a good time. The Draconis Combine's not having a good time. The native Verthandians are not having a good time.
I told you we were going to pronounce this about eight times. So listeners, heads up. As we cover this book,
I'll give you guys
Brent,
one good one, and then that way when it's...
Oh, I'm not.
It's Verthandi, by the way. But I'm going to say it multiple different ways because English is my first and only language, and I'm not good at it.
Yep. Well, and you've stuck with us at this point. You've made it this far, listener.
No.
Oh, man.
No. But, okay, and so, like I said, we don't need to talk about it too much longer, but... Me and Brent kind of just fought amongst ourselves here for a minute. Kane, we didn't get your input on that prologue. What'd you think about it?
Yeah, I do like it, you know, especially coming from the last one. We learn, you know, a little bit more about, oh, here we are. We have House Steiner, House Karita again. You know, we remember them. You know, we've been here before. We know what happens when the dragon gets their claw. You know, they, I don't know, do we? Listen, you know,
not yet.
I think what we learned about the dragons getting its claws into something was they fight on a ridge for a couple minutes and then they give up on the planet.
They let go if you get in a choke point, and they have two medium lasers, and if they have a company of mechs, they feel outnumbered. And then Duke Recall capitulated to a 20-year-old
who may or may not have understood what was going on. But
yes. But that's all in the past now. Viewers, listeners.
Countrymen.
You know, I did notice at the last sentence does say House Karita descended with its iron-mailed fist, which is very funny because isn't the symbol of House Steiner literally an iron-mailed fist? That cannot be like – that must be intentional. Yes. I just thought it was funny. He was like, what if I say Karita has the iron-mailed fist? I was like, oh, okay. That's just, you know, they could have said once the snake got its claws in it.
Absolutely. Or its jaws. You know, almost anything other than mailed fist.
But I just thought it was really funny. I was like, that must be intentional. It's so specific.
I agree. You know, this is my favorite, as I've said previously, of the Grey Death trilogy. But it certainly has its... We are going to see House Steiner is good guys, House Karita is bad guys, and there's not a lot of room for dispute there. We don't get the, like...
In this book.
In this book. Yeah, it's very black and white who the good and bad guys are.
But we have meandered on this prologue for far longer than it deserved.
That's true.
So, but this book really does kick off here. Very quickly here, as soon as we make our way into chapter one. So let's see what it's got.
Chapter one. We immediately get this scene, just this complete horror show. You know, we have a village burning down. You know, the night sky fills with smoke. You see, there's this, we cut to a scene of this village, Mountain Vista, on Verthandi. And there's this marauder. It's a marauder again. You know, we're like, oh yeah, we know this guy. Not the same marauder, but, you know, it's stomping around. I mean, it's this horrible scene, right? It's like, it like blows apart a building with a PPC, collapses it on a bunch of people. You know, he's like shooting people. It's like, you know, it's war crimes. Like, the book opens on like an atrocity. It's horrible. It's just this marauder just stomping through this town, just absolutely. And, you know, we learn the pilot's name, Valdis Kevlavik, you know, good name. And, you know, he's like, yes, this should please the commander or what have you, you know. And then you have, of course, at the end here, right, there's this little bit. He's getting shot at by a sniper. He turns and sees, and it's like, you know, it's this boy with the sniper rifle in the church tower. But he just, what is he? He like grabs him and like pulls him, or he makes him jump onto his thing, even though it's like hot and it's like burning him. And then he like lasers a bunch of people. It's like an atrocity. He ends up like stomping on the chapter ends with Kevlavik crushing this kid with the foot of his marauder. It's terrible.
This shit comes in a little hot, for me, to be honest.
It comes in hot.
It's clearly making a point. Like, these bad guys, they're like, there's a line that's something to the effect of, good, I'm glad there's an audience. Terror works better when someone's here to, like, be afraid of it. And I'm just like, oh, bro, chill, like, a little bit. Like, are you sure you're like, bringing honor to the dragon?
Yes, right. Kevlevic smiled. Good, he thought, to be effective.
So I agree with you. Yeah, it comes in very heavy-handed right out the gate. I mean, clearly establishing, like, we got bad guys. We got bad guys doing bad guy stuff. And it's excessive. And I think it could be very easily argued. Actually, not even argued. Probably just universally agreed on that it's too much here.
Yeah.
But one of the things I kind of was thinking when I was reading this, besides how much I miss Sing, because Sing was such a cool guy to rag on as our bad guy doing bad guy stuff. And this guy's just, you know, full on like...
Kevlovic?
Yeah. Doing it. I'm not even going to try. I'm going to leave it to you. You can get the emails on mispronouncing his name.
Yeah.
But I feel like there is some intention behind this from the prologue, even though it goes kind of contrary about me talking about how I would have rather seen more things in it. You know, it does give you this idea of we're going to be on more of a inhabitable planet. Yes. And I think after reading these first couple opening segments, and I think by going that heavy-handed, you know, we are drawing that parallel to like some of the war movies of the time, you know, some of the Vietnam movies like Apocalypse Now and things like that, where you get that kind of like that graphic telling of war. And I think this does serve that purpose, although, as we said, with, could we say, like a mailed fist?
Yeah.
A mail-clad fist?
It's, you know, we're going into the 80s. We're going into that, like, 80s action movie where it's, like, extra gory. And I kind of get it. But, yeah, it's definitely drawing allusions to Vietnam. And we've established that William H. Keith is a Navy man. And there's definitely something coming up in this next couple chapters that I'm like so excited to talk about because I feel like he's getting some stuff off his chest. But yeah, that's it. There's definitely allusions to Vietnam here. A little heavy handed. And I know you haven't read ahead, but it's going to get more.
I like from here, the reader could discern a pattern, which is that people who pilot marauders are bad people, which seems to be what the writer is illustrating here. Every time a marauder shows up, there's been trouble, which I thought was very funny.
You're not wrong.
Listeners, one of our particular members of this podcast has his hands on his hip and absolutely stunned that such a statement could be uttered.
Here's the thing. I don't have a leg to stand on. He's right. Like, William H. Keith has put every bad guy in a marauder here. We'll see if that changes, but yeah.
Not till now.
It's not a good look for the mech right now, sadly.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so funny. Here we are. He's like, we need some bad dudes. Like, but we need to illustrate that these dudes are really bad. And, you know, war crimes. I love it. You know, how do you open a Battletech book? You know, do a little war crime. You know, just a little bit of atrocity.
Now, that is a concurrent pattern in the Grey Death trilogy.
I guess I can't wait, maybe.
It definitely paints it's a very dire situation. This for Thandi. It would be very dangerous. Looks like a very dangerous kind of a situation. But, you know, yeah. I mean, we're about to get into it, though. This thing kicks off here in a second.
It does kick off here.
And it kicks off with some faces we know you and us have been waiting all week to see again.
Chapter 2. We start Chapter 2, and here it is. Here he is, folks. It's Grayson. We got Grayson again. Where is he? We're not on Trail 1 anymore. We're somewhere else. It's like amazing. How refreshing is that? We made it. Where are we? We're on Galatea. What's Galatea? It's the mercenary star. What are we doing? Well, we've been here 6 months, and we haven't found a job. So, things are, you know, business as usual. But yes, we open, of course. Grayson is having a meeting with Devik Aridin. Devik Aridin, who is a representative for Verthandi, right? It's this whole, a lot, you know, a big part of this chapter revolves around this meeting, this whole dialogue with this Devik Aridin character as he explains the situation on Verthandi. And, you know, this one's pretty, it goes into a lot of detail or a little bit of detail about what's happened since we last saw him. It says it's been about 6 months, right? Or at least they've been on Galatea for 6 months. But it does, you know, it's not like this is years in the future. Like, this isn't that far off. Like, we're kind of picking up basically where we left off. So that's cool. But they've made their way to Galatea, a hiring center for mercenaries from across the Lyrian Commonwealth and beyond. But yeah, so this world of merc units come, right? Right, Brent?
There's a couple hubs at this time, but this is the one, and I think they explicitly say it, you know, members of Fed Sons, Illyrians, and House Merrick tend to hire out of here. And it's kind of a rough and tumble place. It's got real, like, Mos Eisley vibes, without the desert, mind you.
Oh, yeah.
It's very Earth-like.
Definitely, yeah, we got some, you know, scum and villainy, for sure. You know? Oh, yeah, I love it. So, yeah, they've been here for a while. And you're like, okay, people come here to hire mercenaries, but they, you know, these guys are... You know, Grayson's out holding a sign on a street corner by this point. No one's hired them because they only have like five mechs. Most merc companies can provide like at least a company of mechs, you know, at least a couple. It's like, come on, guys, only five. It does say he's got some new guys. Five more mech warriors sign on, two of them bringing mechs of their own, which raises the Legion's strength to seven. So he's been here 6 months. We have seven mechs. We got some new guys. We got tech troops, support troops. They're building. Ramaj is training. Ramaj is here. It mentions him. He's still training up the troops, you know, doing his thing. Renfred Tor, hey, he went and found himself a couple of like fighter escorts. You know, he's got some like space fighter pilots. He found like a duo that we'll learn about soon. These guys are cool. The unit number, just 186 men, including all the crew members, the Invidious, the Techs, the Aztecs. So we got a little something going on. It's not nothing, but it's still small, right? Where like Grayson is a, you know, he's a small fry.
It feels like a force just not big enough to get hired. And I will say one of my, I started this episode off with some criticism, but within this first paragraph of chapter two, I love how Keith got us right back into like Grayson mode.
Yeah.
How that first paragraph rounds off with, unless he could land a job, he'd be forced to disband the unit so his men could find other work among the larger, better equipped mercenary units. And to me, it's just, it's almost refreshing.
It is.
To feel like, oh, we are right back. Like,
it Scrappy did, yeah. Grayson's yeah. back here.
We're here.
You know,
he's paying them in IOUs. You know, he's in a rough spot.
Yeah, and that's where we love our boy. We love him in a rough spot. But, you know, he's flanked out by the Rad Squad who have built some stuff up. They do feel like, oh, you know, we aren't returning back to, like, helpless Grayson. It feels like just... The Graysonism, I think, is that he's in a new world again. He just learned how to be a leader in a political unit within a military. And now it's like, oh, by the way, a lot of that training didn't help you right now because now you're in a whole new world.
You're in a whole new position. And it's now it's the he's got to be a businessman, which is something he hasn't done yet. However, leaning on his other abilities will come in useful here.
And so as we just got back in and we've got, you know, Scrappy Grayson desperately looking for any kind of work, you know, he's selling cell phone plans and mercenary units right now, keeping the bills afloat, which he isn't. And like when it pairs up and as you're going through all of that.
They gave him some money. It says here, Trowan gave him a little cash, but he spent it like immediately.
Yeah.
Like he blew, you know, but just getting food, weapons, ammunition,
port fees,
you know? Yeah. Yeah, it's what Brent said. He starts paying people in like IOUs, and it's like, unfortunately, you know, literally no one accepts, you know, a unit's own notes as payment. That would be insane. Grayson just starts like writing on, he just starts giving people a little piece of paper, you know, just
it's
like,
more or less just, sorry. Please stay.
Yeah.
please don't leave. And they don't because they're just as desperate. There's no one better to turn to. The reason he's hired some of the guys he has is because no one wants just some these oddball mech pilots.
Yeah. We're scrappy. We're still scrappy. Yeah,
we're still scrappy.
Kanan just touched upon it, but I think my favorite thing that got us into there was the fact that he was handing out IOUs. These things are just as good as money. Grayson verified. Grayson backed.
Yeah.
You know, these things are good on Wednesday and sometimes the next month's Wednesday for buying essentials.
Yeah.
So
Burnt rice at the galley tonight again.
It is.
He gives one to Lori, like, this one's, you know, this one's a voucher for free hugs.
She tears it up in front of him, throws it on the ground. He's like, oh.
Hey, remember, we're not getting
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But yeah, I think it really set the scene back into it. And I think, like, after that first part where I was like, oh, we've got a transition here, we get right back to it. And I was just like, Grayson, we're back to Grayson. So I did love that. I loved it so much.
So he's meeting with this guy, Citizen Aridin, which I was like, what? What's the citizen thing about?
Citizen Aridin. That's right. Usually when I hear citizen, I think of the Capellans, right?
Right.
It is true. He does. I mean, but, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm not the guy. Maybe that is also a Commonwealth thing. But you're right. Usually, yeah, when they say citizen, that's a...
They don't seem really that... They're far from, like, Lyrian loyalist, right? Like, these guys, they miss House Steiner's reign, only in that they were a little bit more free to do as they may. But it seems like they're more caught up in their own affairs and their own government. At least that's the impression I get.
Yeah, I kind of felt like we just kind of took one step away from, like, Trelwan and how the people there felt about everything. And he hit him with the same energy, except this time it's like, oh, no, terrible things have already happened. And so...
I think if you took, you know, until you get into planets that are nearer to the interior of, like, the different successor houses' states, I think you do see this as kind of a standard, which is... Everyone's got their own bullshit. And, you know, they're not some, you know, at the top, they might be worried about the machinations of the successor houses themselves. But again, they got their own shit going on. And Vivendi is definitely in that same vogue.
There's something very important, which is that I do want to say they are meeting in a strip club.
All right? I was so excited.
What's it called?
In the back of a strip club.
Marauder Bills with the B shot out. So it's Marauder Ills.
Oh, shit. Marauder Ills. Man, Keith really doesn't like Marauders.
Yeah. Why did he write that?
This thing that Marauder Bills, as we're reading through it, it is like almost a joke. That, like, they throw out this whole description of Marauder Ills as, like, oh, this is the dingiest strip club you've ever been to that serves, like, chicken wings on a Tuesday.
Yeah, it's like, there's a whole paragraph where Keith is like, this is, like, the nastiest, grime-caked, whitewashed, cracked facade. We're, like, way in the back. There's pools of naked dancers and heavily armed mercs. I mean, this is some, like, cyberpunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, my God.
The,
like,
most dystopian thing to come about, though, I don't care about the bar, everything else. The greatest slight to me is that water was $3.50.
Dude, because, right, the other guys, right, what is it? They, like, order a drink, and it's so funny.
What is it?
Like, no, I just water for me, please. And, but you're right, when she comes with the order, yes, I was also shocked that the water, not only was it, like, wasn't that much less than the alcoholic drinks. I was like, man, that's so funny.
And from a sci-fi standpoint, this doesn't really make that much. In odd circumstances, if Galatea wasn't as big of a port-like planet as it is, it would make more sense that water was more expensive. But water is one of the – once we get interstellar, water is one of the most proliferated resources out there. So – yeah. I think this is just some weird, like, strip club, you're not buying alcohol BS, and I will not stand for it.
I was just going to say, though, this outrage was not expressed when we've been in some bad bars before.
Right.
And we've paid for water. So, yes, it's gritty realism in this kind of place. But
it's truly dystopian.
As I was saying about Marauder Bills, like, as I was reading it, I was like, what is this description? But then I found myself absolutely in love with the idea of Grayson in this place, like, so confused.
Dude, it's and Grayson just and lost. Tor, right? Yeah. Grayson and Tor walk in the door. They're like, you know, they, like, look around. There's, like, dancers and like all these like gruff dudes with like guns, and they see this short dude like over in the corner booth.
Somebody shouts out to Tor, like,
yeah,
it's Tor, and he's like, oh yeah.
They walk over, and
Tor's in his element.
Citizen Aridin, please. And I love Tor's like, you know, this guy's from a little place, couple, you know, a few tens of lights from here. He says tens of lights.
Tens of lights.
And I was like, heck yeah, dude, tens of lights.
And with that whole like comedic background that I'm reading this in, and then it goes into like, you know, Tor's working with Aridin's kind of setting this up, this whole scene about what they're going to talk about. And like Grayson sitting the whole time, like, look at this nerd. This dude got glasses because he's such a nerd. And you're like, yeah, he's just riffing on this dude nonstop, yeah, about having glasses. And he's like, most planets can fix them eyes at this point.
He goes on about how glasses are like so weird because
lost tech.
Yeah.
And I was just like, man,
it's like contacts are lost tech.
We've got like proper vision care. It's lost tech and battle tech, which, it's a fun little detail, but I just thought it was like, man, I thought like we were going to have some trouble riffing on Grayson like we did in the last book.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, you know, Grayson's now like this professional and all these things. And it's just like this opening is Grayson writing IOUs, struggling to find work. And then the chance he has at work, he can't help but just be like,
he's right where we left him.
Yeah. And I think that's the part I'm trying to get across here, is just how much I love the fact that he's right where we left him, and the fact that every one of those things just checked the box of just like, man, Grayson, you were just very a jock good to the core.
We love it. We love it. We're right here. Right. So this guy, Aridin, he tells them he's the representative for Verthandi's Revolutionary Council, and they're fighting against House Kurita, and they need help. So he's come here with some money to get some supplies and to get some mercenaries to help train their militia. They're troops. They're fighting like a guerrilla war, and that's why he's here with Grayson. You know, it's a bit of a job interview, right? He's telling him the job, and Grayson's here to hear his pitch and see if it's worth his time. Honestly, this job sucks.
This job sucks. Just to be clear, he didn't come here with money. He came here with precious minerals that he turned in for sea bills.
I see.
Grayson's can't be choosers, though.
That's true. And, well, here's the thing. It's really like, this is fate, right? Because Aridin can't afford to pay Grayson any more than he is going to, and Grayson can't afford to not take a job.
Yeah.
It's truly...
And Grayson's like, also terrible with money, so this is just like, it's the perfect setup.
There is an interesting little bit in the dialogue where, you know, Aridin's talking to him, he's like, yeah, 10 years ago, you know, there was a major Kurita offensive, and Grayson's like, oh, Dahlgren. And he's like, what? There's a little bit, it's like, Grayson was totally there. He was like a warrior's apprentice in Carlisle's commandos. And they were there on Dahlgren when the Sword of Light dropped in behind them and they had to retreat. Yeah, that's when House Kurita took Dahlgren. Dude, Sword of Light dropped in on him. That's so cool. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah. It's not who you want to see. That's a bad day for you.
Right. So Carlisle's commandos were totally there. Grayson was there. Grayson was there the day that Dahlgren fell. You know, they escaped.
Right.
Which, you know, we talked a lot about in the first book about like things that come back and make context. And I mean, this is the second book, so it's totally fair. But I like that little tether to it to kind of like help explain Grayson's vitriol towards the Cretan forces as we kind of got introduced to that, because we didn't get a whole lot of the background of why for that being the first book. So this is just a nice little like finishing touch on that of being like, oh, yeah, Grayson hates the Combine at this point, not just for the first book, but for other reasons, which also helps when, you know, somebody's coming and offering you minerals.
It does, in hindsight, make scenes make more sense with the Trelawneys when he's like, you don't want to work with the Cretans, do you? And they're like, we don't have any problem with them. And it makes things like that make a little bit more sense.
It just ties it together nicely.
I do wish we had gotten it in the first book, though.
Yeah, but like I said, because it's in the sequel.
Yeah.
It's forgivable. It's, you know, it's just, it's,
it sets tethering this up better. Yeah.
So when the Commonwealth lost Dahlgren, they then ceded a number of border worlds to the Combine. Verthandi was one of those worlds. Since then, and if we recall, you know, Verthandi, we remember it was detailed in the prologue. It's a very nice, green, lush world. Lots of, it's a nice place. They got, it's very like, it sounds like kind of Earth-like, you know, they got mountains, they got lakes and rivers and forests. It sounds all right. Much nicer than Trelawne. I'll say that. But
He's like, check it out. The Combine came in. What did they start to do? Like mining, really, it looks like. They came there to drink their milkshake. They wanted those, they have minerals, they have, he goes on to say, first they were just mining, doing some light mining, but they started to escalate and, you know, the citizenry turned against them. There's been unrest, let's say. There are rebels. We're fighting a guerrilla war. There is a resistance. This man is here to, he is representing that, like, resistance.
It turns out you can only reach so deep into somebody else's pockets before they get angry.
Right. Oh, right. And of course, things escalated after, you know, there was a little resistance, and then the Combine escalated. They took control of the Capitol. They brought mechs in. They brought more dudes. They brought military. And so that, of course, then the guerrilla warfare escalates. You see what's happening here. Yep. This is a tale as old as time.
It's out of control. And
it's funny because we do open with, like, the Combine, like, confused. Like, why the fuck does this keep happening? And it's like, I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe it's because you guys are doing the things you're doing.
Yep.
But anyway.
But I actually, after we talked about the first chapter and we talked about how heavy-handed and everything is, it does set this negotiation up this whole time. Because, you know, this guy's kind of talking like, oh, it's guerrilla war. Things have gotten out of hand. Don't get me wrong, Grayson. It's a dangerous time. And Grayson's like, yeah, it's pretty dangerous. But then, like, you keep thinking back to that first chapter and it's like, I don't think Grayson's realizing how out of hand things are.
He does volunteer that he's like, this sounds like it's going to suck, but I agree with you. I don't think he truly understands the gravity. He understands it sucks, but I don't think he understands, even the way this guy's feeding it to him, how bad it sucks.
Yeah.
He's going to find out, though.
Oh, yeah. By the end of the episode that you're listening to, we'll find out how bad things suck. But yeah, I think it was a fun way to reintroduce us back to it, get us right back into the vibes that we were looking for, and watch Grayson accept this contract that he probably shouldn't have. But when you're
his
broke,
hands were really tight.
Yeah, it was. That's like, what he says.
They set it up well.
Yeah, he's desperate. He's desperate. It does, because Aridin tells him there are, like, you know, most of 4 mech regiments on Verthandi. Oh, yeah, like, only one is at full strength, but, like, he could, that's, like, potentially, like, hundreds of mechs, right? That's no joke. 4 regiments?
They are spread out right over, actually, a number of, you know, the moon and, like, all over the world, and so it's not like he's going to have to face these off all at once. In fact, that's not even the job, which is one of the reasons why I don't think the pay is that bad, because the job truly is not for Grayson and his team to fight, but his job is to teach them how to fight. But Grayson's smart enough to know that
he learned his lesson the last time he tried to train a group of people to fight as mech warriors.
And also that, you know, if you're going to play stupid games, you're going to win stupid prizes. And that probably
those are Grayson's favorite kind.
And by landing on Verthandi, he's probably going to get in at least one scrap. So, you know, good on him for calling it, but again, probably not as much.
Yeah, and they round out that decision in this chapter through that admittance by Grayson, where he's saying, like, this job would not be accepted by any other merc group.
Yeah.
And he's like, and unfortunately, we're in the position that we cannot refuse it.
It literally is reminiscent to me. You remember in, like, it was our second episode or so, and Grayson is like, we don't have enough mechs. I've only got a headless wasp and a locust. And he's like, goes for double or nothing. And I feel like we're right back there. We're right back at double or nothing. It's like, I got to take this, maybe make some money, hopefully not die, and we'll be better.
Nobody take this man to Vegas because he's coming home broke. You know, we'll kind of get to the idea of, as he walks away from that agreement and he's thinking to himself, oh boy, it's going to take us into the next chapter where we get to find out exactly who he's working with, what he's working with, as they set plans in motion in the next chapter.
Chapter 3. We open on a scene. We're at the docks now, right? We got everyone. There's a whole bunch of workers. They're loading things, you know, early afternoon, shimmering sun. We're on the tarmac. There's drop ships. We got guys on loaders and moving stuff around. We got, like, loader mechs moving, like, pallets and boxes. You know, we're getting loaded up. We're getting loaded. There's a cargo officer, port officials. It's very cool. It's like a very cool scene. Like to read here, I thought this was nice. It's like a very detailed, we don't have to go into the, but there's a whole, he really does paint this whole scene here about the, like the comings and goings of this, like that, like docking. It's all like, it's all the things that go into, hey, they're just getting the dropship loaded up, but actually there's like a lot going on, you know, there's a, you know, it takes a lot to get,
mechs are being painted.
Mechs are being painted.
And it helps us kind of see Grayson in that new light of like, he's been managing all of this stuff. He has kept it afloat. So he's kind of gone away from like previous book Grayson to more of like perpetually rubbing his temples Grayson. And this little chapter opening and going through this really kind of nails that vibe of like, ooh, there's a lot to do. And is Grayson the right man for that job? I don't know. I have my doubts.
Right. We cut over to Grayson and he's like talking to some dudes. You know, they hand him like a clipboard or like a data pad or whatever. They're like signing off. You know, he's like, you know, everything's in order, like looking good. And it's like two guys, you know, and he's just like chatting with them, right? You know, they're like looking up at the ship and stuff. And like the one guy's looking up at it and they're noticing that, you know, as you said, it's like his like emblems and stuff are being painted over and or they're like putting camouflage on stuff, right? One of the guys is like, oh, so you're going out covert, Captain? And, you know, Grayson's like, nah, just putting a coat of paint on it. No big deal. And he's like, all right, if you say so.
The guys, it's like, some real, like, yeah. Fine then, keep your secrets. I don't care.
Yeah.
which is lucky for that guy, because in that Grayson, in our normal Grayson decision-making platform, it's normally either, like, badly lie or hit somebody and run away. So, like, he chose to lie, so this guy's all right.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
So, those guys walk away, and, right, Grayson's looking up at it. Everything's being painted. He's having a moment. Again, we're having a Grayson moment. We are. He's just like, man, is this, am I making a mistake here? Is this going to be disastrous? He is. There is a little moment. And then Ramaj walks up, you know, Captain, he calls him Ram. He's like, yes, Ram. He loves it. So they're tight now. We got Ramaj. He's back.
We got nicknamed Ramaj.
Nicknamed Ramaj. He's Ram now. He's senior to all the unit support infantry in both age and experience.
I like the idea that nobody else calls him Rom. It's just Grayson. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah. And Ramaj is just like, whatever.
Yeah, they throw it in there. It's just like, it's an inevitable nickname. And you're like, yeah, let's go with it. Let's get our boy Rom up in here.
You know, so he's like, how's it going with the boys? And they're like, you know, honestly, they're a little worried. You know, a tough job. It could get dicey. Everyone knows, you know, even us, we're like, look, this sounds straightforward, but. Even Grayson, when he took that job, there was the whole where he's like, you know, this could get dicey, right? This is a hot situation and there's no predicting. So yeah, there is a moment where Ramaj just tells him like, just so you know, everyone else is kind of nervous too. There's some like kind of bad energy in the air about the whole thing.
Grayson gives him one of the first of a few, basically, warnings and allowances to, you know, listen, I know that this is going to suck, but if you want to get off the ship, get off now. Like, it's no problem, right? Like, but do it now, not later.
I don't know why he hit Ramaj with that. You know, Rom's going to be here. We know he's sticking.
Well, I don't think it's really at Ramaj so much as, like, to his men, you know, hey, you know, spread it, let it be known that, you know, I know I'm asking. This is an ask. And Ramaj is kind of like, you know, everyone's still with you. It's just a little spooky.
And then I love this scene. I feel like you have the camera shot of like Grayson and Ramaj in like the foreground talking to each other. And then this like the vehicle pulls up in like the background and like, and out of the passenger seat, a tall, attractive young woman in a worn and faded military tunic, Lori Kalmar. So here we are. We get Grayson, Ramaj, and then Lori pulls up and gets out. Yeah, we got the whole team.
The band's back together. I do want to say, in my head, I see this little Jeep thing she's in. It's like a little, like, it's like a sci-fi version of those little, like, Suzuki Samurais, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah. Yeah, she pays the driver.
She just, like, climbs out the soft top, you know, like, out the side.
So, sees Grayson, rolls her eyes.
Yeah. He asks her, he's like, you know, what's going on? You know, is there any problems with anything? Or like, no, he had the money. Everything is arranged through Comstar. All we need now is final port clearance and we're set.
I'm sorry. I've got to talk about this. This is a little throwaway note, but there is a time here where basically any kind of mercenary work that's above board in the Inner Sphere is done through Comstar. Obviously, we're only in book two here, but there's lots of other like little Battletech stories and source books, etc. And, you know, there's lots of times where one side or the other in a mercenary contract kind of has some ill will towards each other, and they might not pay, or they might not fulfill their end of the bargain or whatever. And so there's kind of become this standard through what's called, and we'll learn about this more. I'm not going to talk about the Mercenary Review Board in any kind of detail, but they're basically this organization through Comstar kind of helps.
They establish it as it like Comstar's kind of the mediators between all of this.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, it's like a regulatory body.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. That's a good point. That actually is important. There's totally a mercenary review board, and they do. Everyone has like a, everyone, like they have like a credit score, basically. Right. You know, you're like mercenary depending on how well you fulfilled your contracts and whatnot.
And so, and it's all like done in C-bills. So regardless, you know, it doesn't matter if you're working for House Merrick or House Steiner, which this is also useful for the mercenaries, right? Which is they don't have to keep doing these currency conversions between whoever, you know, wherever they are. They can just use C-bills. And so, yeah. It's a bit of a service too.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, they do a good job of kind of establishing that in the next couple paragraphs as we're going through that, of just saying like, hey, you know what, there is an intermediary that's gonna kind of oversee some things.
I like that they don't do what we did and just like they don't do a deep dive on it. They just like, hey,
yeah.
It reminds me of the little thing where they were like talking about ransoming in the first book, where it's like, hey, here's this little detail about the world. We're not going to go too crazy into it, but you get it.
And I will say it's actually something that shows like a lot of improvement in Keith's writing style from the first book to the second book, because we had a lot of times where we talked about like these unnecessary dumps of just straight information, and he could have gone off very, like if it was in the first book, it would have been a whole thing on that Comstar, and essentially what you just said would have been in the book.
Yeah.
But this one just kind of, he throws it out there, brings it up a couple times, and just lets you come to that conclusion on it and basically say, hey, I've established it through dialogue and in the book. Yeah. So
show, not tell.
Yeah. And I think that works better here. Yeah. I think as you're this early on, and it's going
it's
through.
Tell, but you know what I mean.
And then Grayson and Lori share a moment, which is thus, you know, we're closing on the final moments here. You know, we'll be disembarking soon. And they're both just kind of standing there. And Grayson, I like Grayson's thinking to himself about, he's thinking about like some kind of big complications. He's thinking about how this is a really, could get really sticky because their jump ship's going to have to drop them off and then leave, right? It can't hang out because it's a potentially hostile area. So they'll be, you know, they're going to be, you know, up the creek, right? This is a, once they're in, they're committed. And they're both just standing there. They both know it. And like Grayson kind of looks over to talk to her, and she just like, I don't think we have a choice, Captain. She calls him Captain, and he like kind of reaches out to touch her. And then he's like, no, we're not, you know, what's Lori, what's come between us?
Lori reads the room, and Grayson is in typical fashion, mom's spaghetti everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just fumbling. And then, yeah.
You know,
fumbling about. He's thinking about how hostile the contract is.
He reaches out to touch her, but then retracts his hand and thinks better of it. And then he's like, yeah, you're right. You know, we got to do it. We got people counting on us. And then it like, it cuts over to the perspective of this, this spy. It calls him a spy straight up. That guy, it turns out that dude who asked him about like, oh, go in covert or whatever, the guy at the spaceport was there. He's just like an intelligence. It kind of cuts over to him a little bit and follows him. He's been like watching everyone the whole time. It like details. Yeah. So this guy's been keeping an eye on him. He's been watching the dropship and all that. He's been like kind of hanging around him, trying to get whatever he can. So they totally have like a dude like gathering. Somebody's watching them.
It doesn't say this much, but this is just my own headcanon here. It feels like these kind of information salesmen are probably a dime a dozen in ports like Galatea and later Outreach and whatnot. Like,
oh, yeah.
It just makes sense that these dudes and dudettes exist.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it punches home that thought that we got in the very first prologue of the first book, where it was like, you know, it's oftentimes not the battlefield that gets you, it's the person that stabs you in the back. And I felt like just throwing in this little spy character here not only makes all that sense you're talking about, but drives that point home of saying, like, you're never safe. Like,
yeah, keep everything buttoned up, yeah. You know?
Operational like, security is really important on right. Everything that you're going to do yeah. in the Battletech universe.
You know what? It turns out that they're actually doing an okay job, because this dude is like, you know, I haven't been able to get as much as I've wanted to. They've actually done a decent job of security because he didn't just blow it open right away. He's actually having to try really hard to figure out. So Grayson has gotten a little more shrewd, right? In his,
he's learned. Understands.
However, so I like this end. We just had the scene where like Lori pulled up in like the car and like got out, and then it cuts to him. And he's like up on the roof or whatever with like binoculars, and he's watching the same scene. So like you get through his binoculars from a distance, you see the car pull up and you see her get out, and he was like watching them. And he's like, I haven't been able to figure out where they're going, but he like, it says he like lip reads. He like zooms way in on Lori and he watches her. He's like, hold on. It says that the binoculars were equipped to record the movements of their lips for later study. The spy had become a lip reader himself through long practice. From this angle, he couldn't make out Lori's words, but Carlyle was easily visible. You're right. Either we starve on Galatea or are stranded on Verthandi. And he's like, ah, I got it. They're going to Verthandi. He lip reads them through binoculars. So, I mean, you know, that's tough. Grayson did a good job, but dude still got him.
Yeah. And in this, they also do name him here. So I don't know if he's going to come back up later on, but they do call him. I'm not sure if it's either Sinus and Lon or Sinus and Lon.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's right. Yeah, Sinus and Lon.
We do get that name. We do get to attribute it to him in case he comes up later. So
I've gotten feedback about me spoiling stuff, so I won't say.
Thank you.
Yep.
I appreciate that.
Apparently, our viewers do, too. Viewers, listeners.
Countrymen. One day we'll learn.
Right. We get the spy. He hears the words. You know, he lowers the binoculars, smiles sinisterly. Yes, now he knew exactly where the Great Death Legion was bound.
And as many times, and I think it won't be the last time that we do it, but if we were talking about the TV miniseries that this is the episode closer of like, you go through all of this, you get the spy peeking out from the binoculars.
And I got him.
Yeah. And it rounds that, it rounds the whole chapter off with the final statement being, so now he knew exactly where the Great Death Legion was bound. And you're like, oh, well, we just talked this whole time about how this is going to have some bumps in the road for Grayson. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, it's confirmed.
Yes.
There's going to be some bumps.
Confirmed bumpage. Yep.
And I think we'll get right to some of those bumps in the next coming chapter.
Chapter 4. This is the big briefing scene. They're in the dropship, the Phobos. They're hanging out in the lounge, you know, which is his briefing room. I like, there's this, all the other crew members, like, it's like once a day, they like put a sign on the door and they're like, go away, it's an officer's meeting. And so, yeah, we cut to Grayson. He's having like an officer's meeting or, you know, a staff meeting. You can see Nahino. This is the scene of him, you know, talking to his crew. And like informing them about like the situation, what they're about to do. And it's just this cool, this long dialogue, big briefing scene. They're on the drop ship. And this is where we get to meet all the characters, like the new crew, right? This is the coolest. We get to meet the crew here and we have like all these new characters. You know, we love Ramaj. We love Lori, you know, but we've been excited to see, you know, who's going to join the team, you know? Who will be the newest additions to the Grey Death Legion? We got some new heroes here. They're all around the table. They're all like studying the contract. And Grayson's kind of just like, they're all kind of hunched over, just like looking at papers. And Grayson's just standing there, just like watching them. And then he just kind of, we get this whole section where he goes around the table and we get like a short, like a little description of all the new characters. Davis McCall, dude.
Davis,
this dude rules.
Motherfucking McCall.
Dude.
Davis McCall was a big, friendly Caldonian with a engaging grin. Fierce pride in his Terran Scots ancestry and a frequent, unintelligible Scots burr. He had brought his own battle mech to the unit, so he's one of the two that brought his own battle mech. A 60-ton rifleman, affectionately known as the Bannock Bairn, which is... for anyone listening, is a stream in Scotland. I did the true? Research you did? So you didn't wow. have to. Yes.
Wow. A rifleman, dude. 60-ton rifleman. This thing rips.
Maybe this one will last rips, longer.
Dude.
Maybe this one will last longer than our last sight of a rifleman, which was like, oh, look, a rifleman. Anyway.
This was something as I was reading through it, and it opened with McCall. And I was like, I've never been more sure of anything in my life than how excited Brent will be.
I was very
soon as we hear this, and I was like, oh,
you,
man.
I want to say, Aaron, that you're missing out by not listening to the audiobook, because Trent Sparks kills the, like,
he kills it.
He kills the, he like, well, I always kept him shame. Like, he kills
he gives everyone a different voice.
Yeah.
And they're all pretty good. Yeah. He's really good.
But our boy Davis McCall gets used to humorous effect immediately. Let's finish the introductions first.
Next to Davis, we have Delmar Clay. Delmar Clay is the other mech warrior who brought a mech. He has a Wolverine. He's like a former Hanson's Rough Riders. And he's lean, dark-haired, and untalkative about his past. Okay, so we got the bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got the...
He says he wears his distinctive olive drab green combat jacket that's like cut off, with the Rough Riders patch.
This guy's cool. Wolverines are cool.
Wolverines are rad.
Delmar Clay, good name.
You see him like with the boots up on the table. Mm-hmm. He's got that energy right away.
Hands behind his head. Yep, totally.
And then next to him is, this guy didn't bring his own mech. They put him in the Stinger. So this is one of the guys they hired. It's Hassan Ali Khaled. And, darker, quieter, and even more reticent about his past than Clay, dude. So we have the bad boy, and then we have, like, this dude's even
secret boy.
Yeah, we got the stoic boy.
His power level completely concealed.
Yeah,
totally hidden. He admitted privately that he had spent most of his life as an Ikwan, brother of the Soramat Commandos from Saul Kala. Quick death.
I meant to look this up. I want to know more about the Saramat Commandos. At one point, I did try to, and I think I just misspelled it, to be honest.
Don't doubt it.
But I straight up want to know more about the Saramat Commandos.
They compare them to ninjas and assassins. And yeah, so he's in the Stinger, He's the Yaren replacement. RIP.
The name meant quick death.
Oh, then we got two others. We got Peter Dabrowski. And how does Trin say it? Is it Haleg? Jorulis?
Yaleg?
Peter Dabrowski?
I'm going to say Yaleg, it's Jaleg Jorulis. Or Yaleg.
I think we can all sit here and we'll go. We might be pronouncing it wrong. I'm sure there's a couple different ways.
Okay, hold on. Jorulis was a short, stocky black. He was Slavic. So I'm going to say it is Yaleg. Yaleg.
Yeah, I was going to go with the Yaleg as well. So we'll just agree here that we're pronouncing it Yaleg.
Right. So, yeah, we cut over to these two dudes like, hello, like little neck pilots. They're the Wasp pilots. So we got these two Slavic dudes in the Wasp. This rules.
Yeah.
Peter Dabrowski and Yaleg Urlis. Like, hello, baby. No problem. You take a Wasp, you shoot the laser. It's easy.
I get like energy like these two dudes are like moments away from wrestling each other at all times.
And there's some real high fivers too. You know what I mean?
Absolute high five energy.
I'm putting them up because I don't remember these guys. I've read this Mercenary Star more than I've read Thunder Rift, and I don't remember these guys at all. So I'm going to go ahead and say that this is my early petition for the D-listers.
I accept the nomination on the condition that they are accepted as a singular
entity. I agree that I think that's the only way we can do it.
It's like, dude, they're like the ice climbers.
Yes, exactly.
They both of them, if you put them on the table, they'd both be on the same little hex base.
We'll see.
There'd be like two of them.
We might still have some more nominations, but now,
And then down at the end of the table, the two most recent additions, Jeffrey Sherman and Suellen Klein, they are the fighter pilots. They have Chippewa fighters, and they're lovers, too.
And I believe they get these Chippewas, it's described from they were the sole survivors of a little skirmish between the Lyrians and the Combine. So they are.
Oh, yeah.
They are no lovers of the Combine, either.
Yeah, and I know when I was reading it, I was like, man, we just got all these cool named characters, and then we wind up with a Suellen Klein. It was just like, whoa, what a name to kind of take you back on that one.
Yeah, Sue Ellen Klein. It's not very Lyrian, right?
No,
like,
but there's no problem with it because
I think it's more of a Torian name myself.
Sue Ellen getting a truck.
However, I don't want to say a lot about the Chippewa, but I do want to for those that didn't do the Sarna reading when we pulled up to a Chippewa. So aerospace fighters, they're a whole thing, right? The reason they're aerospace fighters and not jet fighters is because they can go in and out of Atmo, right? They can fly in space. Technically, they're not flying in space, but, you know, whatever. But they can fly in atmosphere, given the correct conditions. The Chippewas, this is really good for Grace, and these are no slouchers. These are heavy aerospace fighters. They have really good payloads, even for the time. And, like, this shit would be scary for close air support. They've got two LRM-15s, which are long-range missiles, four large lasers, two small lasers, two medium lasers, and an SRM-6. And then he has a pair of them. They're fucking scary. This, honestly, as a force multiplier with all of the mechs he's got, but it's a pretty good team.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's cool that we kind of get to see a new type of combat unit here. We get an air asset.
Yes.
And for those of you wondering, we're going to be talking about those air assets
real soon.
Yeah, we're going to get to see them and how they're used. So
I have to mention, seated between Tor and Ramaj was Ilsa Martinez, which is Tor's first officer. So she was part of the crew. If you remember back in Thunder Rift, she was the one, they left her up on the ship, but she's been with Tor for years. She's like she's like OG, and says she's very, you know, she's very surly, right? Loud, even brassy. She's the best. And so she's going to be the dropship pilot as well. She's going to be the one to take them down. She's very cool.
I love this character. She's rad.
They set her up well. They give you that clear image right off the bat of, like, she talks shit because she's earned the right to talk shit. And I always love a character that's earned the right to talk shit. So
she says what she needs to.
Yep. And, you know, it is like, you know, that whole section just rounds off our introduction to the Grayson Breakfast Club that we have now assembled of fun characters.
They're rad. This is what I remember back in Decision. I was like, just wait, you think this is the rad squad? The real rad squad shows up in this one. Yeah. And
the ratty baddies.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a pretty solid crew.
Yeah.
A pretty solid mix. I do have one more technical bit to talk about, which is the fact that I don't think it's mentioned in this book. However, doing a little bit of research for this, I realize now that Grayson isn't in the traditional Union class dropship in which I thought he was in. He's actually in a Trojan class dropship, which is a bit of a, like, it's made in the periphery. It's kind of like, it's got some real, you know, YT-1300 vibes, you know, it's some real Corellian freighter business. The Sarna notes are like, no two are the same. It's not even exclusively designed to be a dropship for mechs. It's just like a dropship for stuff. And it doesn't really describe it, but I think this colors everything that's about to happen so much better, knowing that it's kind of this like weird periphery junker.
It sucks.
Well,
interesting.
The Phobos specifically is what I'm talking about.
Our boys shouldn't have anything nicer than that to start. So
I agree.
I'm glad they have.
I do too. Yeah. I just thought it was cool. That's, yeah.
But it's just Grayson. He's just standing there. You know, they're all, he's looking at everyone. They're all like reading the contract. And he's just like, oh man, they hate it, don't they? He's like just watching them. And they, I just feel like they're all like frowning, like turning pages. Just like, he's like, uh-oh. And and he's like, you know what? I got to step up. I got to be a leader.
He's learning.
You see the copies, you know, McCall was grinning, which was usual for him. And and Yarlis exchanged some private joke with Dabrowski. So they're over there like elbowing each other, like, you know, cackling about. And Grayson's like, all right, people, you know, it's not a lot, but, you know, people, what do you think? You know, you see the contract, you see the terms.
You know, you got McCall like, the lad is neck deep in the fertile, you know, everyone's.
McCall's on board. He's a team player. He's just like, I'm here with you, laddie. You know, right.
I do love that McCall's the first one to speak up in it because it nails home that idea of like, we just talked about all these Breakfast Club team members, but it's really like mercenary command with training wheels on for Grayson right now where it's like, oh, these people are unhinged in their own right.
Yeah.
So like he can get away with selling this dog's dinner of a contract.
This is what I mean. He always has this dirty dozen kind of ragtag, you know, feel to it. It's very cool. But, you know, he's like talking to him. Look, it's a rough one. Not going to lie to you. We got to train this army. We're going to Verthandi. It's like a jungle. We got to stay there for like 900 hours.
It's going to be a bit of a special operation. We've got to get into the planet.
Yeah, there's like hundreds of Karita mechs. He's like, but you know, the terms are generous. And then what is it? What someone like does the, oh, Delmar Clay, like does the math.
Yeah.
And he's like, dude, it's like nothing. He's like, when you split it up, like, it is like, we're not getting paid very much. Just straight up, dude. He's like, he does the math. And Grayson's like,
When I read this, I straight up saw Kanan. Like, I saw you over there, like, on your fingers, like, hold up, Grayson.
Yeah. I have seen this head tilt on you before, Kanan.
Yes.
Me and Brent are deep in the weeds of something that we clearly didn't think through. And you go, hold on a minute, boys. Please just listen to me for a second. And he throws out that number of,
Ilsa jumps in, you know, because Delmar's like, he's like, dude, it's like 4K a piece. And then Ilsa's like, don't forget, expenses get taken off the top. So he's getting roasted, right? Grayson is getting roasted.
He hasn't even finished his bit.
This scene. Yeah. I love the two young kids, though, the two like the WASP pilots are like, they're all eager. They're like, you know, it'll be good.
Which doesn't help Grayson. I forget how it's worded, but I've every time I come up upon it, I'm like, oh, this is great because, you know, everyone else is shit talking and Grayson's like, yeah, that's valid. But then these two eager young ass dudes that I think are around the same age as him and they're like, we're with you, Captain. Like, we're going to slay the enemy. And Grayson just like, oh, no. Like, it's some real, like, their energy is actually, it does the opposite. It really, like, lays home how, like, how horrible everything is. And that he's like, they don't understand.
Yeah. It's like offering a couple kids, like, allowance money.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that doesn't even buy dinner.
They say something to the extent of, like, it's better than us, you know, sitting at a Galatean bar, right? And he's just like, oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I'm like, no, actually, sitting at a Galatean bar sounds way better than this, honestly, if it was me.
Everyone else at the table's lost.
Fortunate Son plays. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to go get another job. It's been chill. You know, like you guys, but everyone's like, it's mostly in what he goes around the table and asks, the kids, you know, the two WASP pilots are like, count this in, Captain. And like the Hassan Khaled is like, he's like, what do you think? And he's like, it's not my place to advise you. You have my bond. And Grayson's like, all right. What about you? And like the fighter pilots, you know, they're like, we're with you. And then Grayson thinks to himself, you know, romances and battle mechs don't mix. And then, he's like, but he's just mad about Lori.
Yes.
There's this whole little side. Yeah. He's just like, you know, Lori backed off from him. It's none of my business. Unless it starts affecting the operation, then I'll make it my business. And it's like, all right, dude.
Yeah. This, he works himself up about this. And I think we see the consequences of him working himself up about this literally the next scene over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is like one of those things where we've got Grayson, he's stepping up, and it wouldn't be a Grayson book without every step up also including a step back into poor leadership, where it's just like, I'm mad that these two people have a romance. It's bad business. Why doesn't Lori love me anymore?
Yeah, that's I love it. There's a whole, that's exactly what this paragraph is. He's like projecting
it's all just going through his fingers, but inevitably he's like, I guess they're on board enough. There's enough of them on board that it'll be all right, I guess. And I just see him just kind of like turn around and leave while everyone's shouting at each other.
Yeah.
However, immediately after, there's a little break, and it's like, in the end, none of the 186 members chose to remain on Galatea.
So he's got pulled.
Everyone's coming.
Yeah. He pulled it off somehow. He managed to keep.
He does it
We'll see if there's not some more complications as we go.
I can't imagine it. In this book?
Right. So they're on the ship, right? They're on the Phobos, the Invidious. They're docked to the Invidious. They're heading to the jump point. And we get this Grayson found Lori in the observation lounge. We get a Grayson and Lori scene here. We get the, what is it?
She's the long awaited Grayson.
Sitting
Lori
there,
scene.
Looking out at the sun. Oh, right. And so they're in zero G. So he like drifts into the room, you know, he like catches a thing, comes out next to her. Hello, Captain, Lori said, but did not look out at him. I love it. I hoped I'd find you here. It's beautiful. You're looking worn to a frazzle. Trouble sleeping? So they have a little dialogue, you know, and they're coming together. He's thinking about himself. Basically, this is, you know, there's an illustration that they've, you know, they've kind of been distant because of the trauma and all that.
Well,
because of what everyone's been through. And
is it distance or did nothing really get established in the
right,
first
or
place?
That.
This is what.
Yeah, that's true.
Every time the scene comes up when I read it, I go, especially after we just dissected Decision at Thunder Rift, right? I'm like, they really never got that first foot forward in the first place. It was all like, it was some real like first grade, oh, I'm sitting next to her in class and it's like, oh, I can feel her warmth next while we're in the cockpit together.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's some real like, there's something there, but it's like lots of not spoken things. And Grayson being a young man who I feel like the thing with Mara was he just kind of bumbled into. He was just like doing his finger gun thing.
Yes. Because
and
we've seen him try to start something. Well, actually, I say that. I'm incorrect. Lori tries to start something every time. And in
that's
this
right.
scene,
yes.
tries to start something again. And Grayson just whiffs it. He's playing a different sport every time.
Well, he it's funny because his internal dialogue, he like actually, you can tell he's actually reading it, but the things that he's saying and what he's feeling inside and what he's saying are two different things. And he goes, I should really comfort her here. But instead, he reprimands her and he's like, well, I'm going to need you in tip top shape because we're making.
It's a true fumble.
Well,
it's like
this
a textbook
one,
fumble.
To give our exact what we're talking about here.
He knew what the play was.
Yeah.
But he just, the execution is very sloppy.
Yeah. She mentions to him and she gives him the opening here again. Gray, I don't know if I can face it again. She's opening up. She's making herself vulnerable for a second. And it's just like, Grayson, talk to me. And Grayson, like, puts on sports dad cap for this answer and goes like, you'll do fine, Lori, get out there and give it your all.
Which is not, she's looking for a little bit of intimacy, right?
Yeah.
Like a little bit of like, I know.
We get such a good, we get an incredible Graysonism. All right. It's like, then after that, right, exactly. He's like, oh, you'll do good, kid. And it's like, Grayson wasn't sure what had happened to Lori on Trelwan. He did suspect that it had to do with a critical moment during the battle when her locust had been sprayed with liquid fire. Oh, do you?
Yeah, that's probably it, huh?
Yeah. He's like, what about that? Yeah.
It's a shame we lost Clayton in the last book. We need him as a direct advisor to Grayson. Yes, Grayson, it was that moment. It was exactly that moment.
It was the moment where she screamed over the comms, when she broke operational security to yell, help, Grayson, I'm burning.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then remember when you ignored that so that you could pick up that arm to like beat that marauder or whatever.
He did come around. He put the arm down and ran to her aid.
He threw it.
Yes.
He threw it and ran.
Across the planet. In very poor timing.
Like, that like Team Rocket, like bling.
But hey, Grayson, remember when she explicitly told you that she was had a trauma of fire? Remember when she like
and
literally
you
said that to you?
And you said that ignorant ass shit
had to do
like
with that fire. It's like, yeah, dude.
If I had known you were so afraid of the fire, then I wouldn't have used it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just,
I love it.
Oh boy.
I wonder what she's upset about.
Yeah. It's a mystery.
I love you get this funny bit where they jump mid sentence where she's like mid dialogue. She's like, Gray, I'm
She actually drifts into his arms as this happenings, which I'm going to be honest with you, that would terrify me. I'd be worried about, as the kids used to say, getting telefragged. You know what I mean?
My kids always tell me about being telefragged.
I know.
I'll say this. None of them are kids anymore. That's for sure.
That's true. Yes. That's why I said as kids used to say. Look how old I've become.
Is it me who's wrong or the kid? No, the kids are telefragging. But,
yeah, so they make the jump. It's cool that the scene just continues mid-jump. Is this like, you know, are they symbolizing that they've crossed a threshold in their relationship? I don't know. You know, maybe.
Not with Grace.
I don't think they've made any progress at all. And I think this scene is a point that if Grayson really wants this to work, he's going to have to do anything.
Hopefully, maybe by the third book. Yep. Isn't that one called Realization at Thunder Rift? Where he goes, oh
my God. Yeah, he's like, sorry. He decided to risk confronting her. Lori, was it the fire? You told me your parents died in a fire. Dude, don't say that. This is not the moment. That's like, don't say that.
Listeners.
Grayson puts his hands in his pockets. Romance shouldn't be on a ship.
And he's just pulling spaghetti out. It's just like, it's some real mask zero G meme.
Like the spaghetti is like coming out of his like pockets on his vest.
The thing is it keeps getting worse.
Yeah.
Like, the whole time, every next sentence that Grayson says is a worse thing to say. Because as he says that, he
props to Keith because he's killing it with the romantic tension.
Oh yeah,
right? Like, because
no, he's killing romantic tension. He's not killing it.
I think he's writing. No. I think he's doing a good job at writing this like character who, you know, he's pretty good at working under duress in combat, you know, things he's trained for. But, you know, but the emotions of a woman, it's a little, you know, it's a science outside of his grasp at the moment.
Yeah. And it's proven in this next statement he says to her, where Lori just keeps going, maybe I'll give him one more pitch here every time.
Yeah.
And she hits him with the, I don't know. I have dreams. I wake up and I can't get back to sleep. I'm afraid I'm going to fold the next time. I'm no good. Just absolute, just laying it out there.
Yeah.
Grayson answers, that sort of thinking isn't going to get you anywhere, young woman.
Oh, no.
And I was like, I highlighted young woman in this. I haven't felt... that felt like sandpaper against my brain.
This is saying, dude. I think it's good.
This man says it's only natural that you get the it's only natural that you get the wobbles after the close call you had, but you'll be fine. The wobbles, Grayson.
The wobbles.
Oh no!
This young woman got the wobbles.
It's only like the deepest set trauma in my psyche. It's only like the death of my parents and hearing their like their screams mutter out as the fire engulfs them. It's only that, Grayson.
I just see Grayson reaching into his pocket and pulling out Aridin's glasses and putting them on. He says that line. Just like, oh man, it's gotten bad.
And he whiffs it. Whiffs it. TLDR.
He strikes out again. Lori eventually at this point just says, I think I just need some time. And then she just leaves him alone as she should have.
Yeah.
And Grayson like rationalizes it. He makes it seem like he's like, perhaps the best thing was to keep up a strictly professional wall. She needed the time, and I needed her to be an efficient second in command. You know, a romance would actually just distract her, and actually I need her to be my, you know, it's as the company XO. I mean, he's right. Also,
audience, it's never good to lie to yourself. Remember that.
But must be fun kicking that can in zero G.
If he came here to like pump her up, right? Because he's right. She is the second in command, you know, and he came here to be like, you know, this was supposed to be the scene where it is unsatisfying. You know, it didn't, she is not inspired by the end.
But here's the thing though, is that she's been doing all of her duties as an XO. That is not even what's at the only thing that was the only subject here was their emotional connection. And he completely missed the ball.
Yeah. And as you said,
because professionally it seems like she's been performing all of her duties to the letter.
And as you said, with that, you know, I think it's very well written for that. Like, I am not dogging Keith here about this scene because I think it's so fun.
It sells Grayson.
Yeah, it does. It keeps
him. Know, he's not a Mary Sue. He doesn't have it. You know, he's good at Grayson shit. And when it's not Grayson shit, he's not good at it.
Yep.
He's working on it, though. Our boy's working on it. We'll see.
I hope not. I love these.
So she returns to her quarters. Oh, yeah. Grayson suggested, he's like, if you have trouble sleeping, you know, go get some sleeping pills or some, you know, go talk to the medic. But she's like, nah, I don't want to. She goes back to her quarters alone. You get this little scene. You know, I feel like it's her, you know, it's a little like metal room. You know what I mean? She's got the little bunk. She like curls up on it. She's thinking about it. But she does admit here. She's like, yeah, there is like a weird barrier. She's like, it's weird. Because that's really what is like. They're both being a little weird with each other. There is like that wall of weirdness is what she's saying. She's like,
it's almost like because they're not talking about it.
She's, you know, she's more emotionally intelligent than him, but even she's having trouble being like, what exactly? She's not sure. Basically, this is a little scene where she's like, what is going on?
You know, because nothing really was established. It was all just like, is it just because like,
The race stopped short before it started.
Right.
But no. Lori's putting some self-blame here. No, it's Grayson's fault. Sorry. This proves it's Grayson's fault because she gave him a chance.
She gave him the chance.
More chances than he deserves.
Yeah. The problem is she's still reading Grayson, right? She sees through. The problem is that Grayson's not selling it to her, but she still sees through and is like, oh, he's just not. Like, she still sees the truth. And Grayson's just the one that's like, well, I need you to be professional here, Lori. I think we've beat this divorce, though.
Yes. We know how handsome I am, Lori. So I'm going to need you to deal with that. He walks away. No, and I think that does wrap that up. It does give us a nice little tension point here, as you said, of we have that relationship that is established on the ship. Grayson has to look at that, look over at Lori and go, God, I'm doing something terribly wrong. If only I could think about that, but that's not what I do.
If only I could use my words to talk about how I feel.
But
there is something, though. It does seem that Lori does have a real, like, she is a little worried about her performance. That wasn't a lie. You know, it does seem like there is a little underlying, you know, she's like,
she's worried. Burning the wick at both ends because of this.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it does set that up. And I'm sure we'll get a payout for it. That is something I absolutely have some faith in Keith here, that we'll have a payout for it, for the good or the bad. So, you know, we'll get closer to that as we get into the next chapter, which has a whole different bunch of problems for Grayson to face.
Chapter 5. This one starts with the Invidious has jumped in. We are now in the system, the Norn system, which is the star system that Verthandia is located. We have made the jump. We are in system. We are ready to release the dropship, right? The dropship's loaded. You know, we're here. We are on the doorstep of this thing being a beyond the point of return, basically. Because like I said, once they go, they're going to have to jump out. And Tor, it's cool. We get this little scene. I feel like Tor and Grayson are like walking. Yeah, in the conduit line, metal webbed passageway along the Invidious' spine. How cool is this? You know, they're standing that, you know, it's all spaceshipy looking, all metal and conduits and whatnot. It also details that after they departed, they repainted the ship, right? I don't know. I think I might have forgot that they mentioned that earlier, that to run the blockade, they were just going to paint over their logos and like they were going to paint Combine stuff on it to try to get through so that they get down to the planet's surface. So, you know, they're watching them. They've sprayed the ship, the Phobos, and they've done a bunch of stuff with the computer ID and the transponders and whatnot. You know, they're trying to sneak in. They did work on the ship.
They somehow managed to get some old Combine codes too.
Right.
Yeah, they kind of go bit by bit of kind of where this deception starts and like their plan, but bouncing between Grayson and Tor here talking about like, okay, we got the visual side done because we've got it painted. We should be able to relay some old codes and we're going to have to kind of bluff our way through that. Every point of this isn't going to hold up to scrutiny. So we just have to kind of move quick, move fast, and try to play it off as naturally as possible so we can just get down to the surface. Because once we're there, we're relatively in the clear.
We can hide. And yeah. and Citizen Iridan, he mentions that like we can hide in the swamps and that there's a place that we can stay in some caves and we'll be all hunky-dory able to hide.
Yeah. The biggest danger is just reaching it.
It's just getting there.
For right now. And
there's some stuff coming up where I'm like, why is Grayson on the comms and not, why isn't Redford Tor the one that's bluffing his way? I'm just saying, if you're, you know, if we're running a RPG campaign and you put your smooth talker up, you know, for the bluff roll. That's all I'm saying. But yes, you're right.
But Renfren's on the drop ship.
Yeah.
Or the jump ship. Right. Yep.
He is Renfren stays behind.
That's right.
That's the thing. That's what this scene is that them, he's standing outside the Phobos. This thing is loaded and like ready. They've jumped in.
Right.
But like it's Tor and he's like, I don't like it. You know, he's like, I don't like it.
Grayson's like,
we're committed. I don't know what I can do. You know, we just got to slip past him. And Renfren's like, they'll be looking. They'll be patrolling. I'm just saying, this is dicey. That he reminds him, look, I'm going to jump out. I'm going to be back in 980 hours, which is what that was, because that's their time. That's their contract, right? They're like, they got to be there for like 990 hours or whatever. And so he's like, we're going to jump out. We're going to come back and get you. But he's like, you do have a beacon though. There is a way. There's like something. He's like, you know, you have the beacon because you're probably gonna have to cut and run. They talk about it. He's like, look, there's a decent chance that stuff's going to go crazy. And Tor's like, we're going to try our best to, Tor is just expressing concern because this is very dangerous. And he doesn't want to send his friends out to die.
It's a very normal conversation that Tor and Grayson seem to have every time they get together of like, this probably isn't going to work. And they both look at each other and go, yeah, but
they do come up with some contingency plans. So good on them.
And they have done good at that every time. But essentially it still boils down to like, there's a fail point in everything that we're doing. So good chance it's going to get messy.
You see some real like, you know, take it easy, kid. Yep. It's like you too.
They end it like
clasp hands. Yeah. You know, they lock arms.
They get like a less cool Grayson, predator handshake. Say goodbye.
Yeah. Yeah,
totally. And then he like walks through the onto the drop ship and the hatches seal shut with the hiss of and then he like release the drop ship and it just like begins its descent towards Verthandi.
And which gives us that little like cut point that we're looking for in the show, that fade out point of, you know, okay, we're locked in. There's no going back at this point.
I would definitely fade out with the 2001 A Space Odyssey. You know, you see the shadow, you know, like the sun, Norn, is like shining and like the shadow is like being cast as the dropship gets further away. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That isolation of space there. Exactly. Grayson is now alone.
And distance is closing between him and his bud Tor.
And he's got to survive for the next 980 hours on his own. Well, with his team, but you know. Without a safety net. So, and that cuts right into an introduction of another character. So we've had a lot of new characters introduced, but this one doesn't seem like he's going to be joining the Rad Squad. So.
Oh, yes. This is we get our villain introduction. You know, this is our Haramander Singh. This is our Combine. You know, this is our new Operation Serpent or whatever. Yes. You cut down to Verthandi. We're in the capital city. You know, it's a jungle. The capital city of Regis, the upper towers of the administrative complex, right? So we cut down, city surrounded by jungle. We're in the high tower. Who's in here? Governor General Masayoshi Nagumo. So.
Nagumo, you animal.
That's our guy. He's up here. You know, it's very, ornate. He's got the black Draconis Combine officer uniform with like the Kana on the collars. It's sick. He's got like a hand laser, you know, he's got a mustache, of course, that goes without saying. And he's up here, he's hanging out with Olaf Haraldsson. And this guy, he's got a Verthandian uniform on. The crest on Haraldsson's tunic was the emblem of the University of Regis. And so he's up there, he's talking with Nagumo, and They're having a little meeting. It seems that Olav Haraldsson has come to suggest that a good way to bring peace to the region is to like offer peace to the region. And Nagumo's like, no.
Nagumo's like, no, we will have the Pax Draconis, which just means the dragon's peace.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, buddy, that's what I was saying. He was like, just like, they're probably tired of fighting. Just tell them you're not going to shoot them and they'll probably give up. And he's like, no, I don't care what you have to do. We'll kill everyone. You know,
This is one of those like eyeglass Sheen moments as he's like, I'm just saying it might go a long way if we try to do very, very teeny tiny compromise here. And it's just like,
have you tried not shooting them?
Yeah. And he goes, excuse me, who are you? Because I don't think so. And I mean, I will say as this introduction, Keith has done such a good job like introducing our like political bads.
Yeah.
Because this guy gives you a flavor right away.
Totally.
Like you feel that like somebody's pouring him tea as he's getting ready and like that teapot shaking like, you know, it's rattling and clanging and he's just looking disapprovingly. This dude always is looking
disapprovingly. I feel like this guy has risen from the top and he's mostly incompetent, but his viciousness has got him as far as he's gotten. And I think that's really the scene we're seeing here is it's like, you know, he's like, yes, you will bring me the leaders of the revolutionaries and I'm gonna put them on pikes while they're still alive. You know, there it's some real like, no, fuck them.
And I also think Keith does a really good job like introducing this character alongside Haraldsson, because you've got that kind of native guy who's, you know, you can kind of feel that energy of like, I have kind of come to this side to help mitigate and try, like, I've made the bad choice for myself to try to do something decent, try to like, you know, stop the bleeding a little bit.
Yeah.
But like that moment where you get to see him realize like, oh, not only I've sold myself, but there will be no, like, I got nothing.
It's clear that this guy, he's in this position because he was like, well, I can still do good here, right? I can still maybe help out my people by being like a buffer between, you know, it's some real martyr shit. But this guy's having none of it.
Yeah, and it just was like, there's nothing coming.
And you get the idea that you know, it's all the center of government is all the University of Regis. It seems like it's very, these are mostly like scholarly people. Like this is like, and
bunch of glasses wearing nerds.
Yes. Yeah. As Grayson says, you know, and I think the guy even says, he's like, all of their notions are of art and like, they have no notions of like, you know, they're not just about the pecking order, the like the power.
He's basically laying it out. They cannot resist you.
Yeah.
So why must you go to this extent when we've already seen that we are hopeless?
And again, the guy just has.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he follows that up literally saying, you, my spineless lapdog of, you know, just like chopping this guy down. And I think it does, as I was saying, by bringing him in, you get this micro view of what's happening on the macro scale of like, this is going on across the planet. Yeah. And then you pair that with our chapter one opening, which is that heavy handed violence. And you're just like, oh,
that's why there's a revolution going on. What's going on right here? This is the problem.
I hope those minerals are real pretty. Because Grayson's in for a load of shit. And I think that's what this really nails, is this is so much more. Grayson has agreed to something that is so far out of control. And so, you know, his 980 hours of training mech warriors is not going to solve this problem.
He's going to learn today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
However, I do like the scene, though. I think that this Keith does a great job of setting this up.
He admits Nagumo here. Admits he's like, you know, I'll give them amnesty. The amnesty I gave Mountain Vista, which is, that was the, that's the town from the first chapter.
Right.
By the way. So he does admit to being the one who ordered the atrocity on Mountain Vista. So this is, this directly linked, you know, what happened here? It was this guy. He was the one, because exactly, you can see here, the dude's like, shouldn't we? Well, then what do you want me to do? And he's just like, kill them, literally eradicate them. Basically. He's just like, there's only one option here. You need to kill everyone.
He's all just right? like, I'll burn.
That's what's going to happen.
It's like, you do it or I'm going to burn down the fucking jungles. And we're going to glass this place and I'll bring in new people.
And no one but me will remember. Yeah. And I'll forget very shortly. And it's just like, oh boy.
I love Nagumo. He sends the dude away. And I do like, he says, man's a fool. He wants to remain well-liked by the people while maintaining the privileges of his position, which is correct. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's a, he read him like a book. Totally. Though. I was like, that's a good way to, I was like, he's right.
And we've seen how good things go for Grayson when he's paired up against somebody that's really good about reading people. So, you know, once again, more steps building up to Grayson's.
However, I will say this, the dire situation here, it is a benefit to Grayson. This guy's such a prick that it's going to be so easy to rally the people. People are begging for any help at all, even if it's them helping themselves. They just need something to rally behind. And that's pretty clear. This guy's just creating this pressure cooker, and that's how you make diamonds, people.
Especially out of a bunch of minerals.
Yeah.
But don't forget, it's very important that I get it right, because he sends the academician away. You know, you see him like leaving the room and like he goes through the double doors. And then as soon as he leaves, in comes behind him, Valdik Kevlovic, the mech warrior from the beginning of the book, the guy who destroyed Mountain Vista in the Marauder. That's who he's talking to when he says that, like, the man's a fool. And, you know, Kevlovic's like, it's time to replace him, my lord. So right here we get the head bad guy and the enforcer, the second in command. You know, you got your two.
You got the man of action and the man right behind here. The action. So,
you know, he's like, you know, how went the campaign in Mountain Vista? And it's like, Nagumo already knew. He read the reports. He just wanted to hear it. And so like the dude can be like, so good. Well, we killed everyone. You know, a man and his family tried to escape. We like murdered them ruthlessly in the town square. And he's like, good.
I squished the
child. And then of course, Nagumo's think it's very, you know, it's very Sith master apprentice rule of two. It's like, you know, yeah. Cause Nagumo's like, good. And then he thinks to himself, but you are just as much of a fool as Haraldson. He's like, one raid will not change their mind. The rebellion will end when they're all dead. He's really on this. Nagumo is just like, dude, we have to eradicate. We need like an ethnic cleansing. Man, this is like War Crimes, the book.
Yes. this very first part, absolutely. But I also want to give Keith a lot of credit here, because in that conversation, I think he takes a moment, and I wouldn't say subtly, I would say out in the open, exposes the weakness. Of like, this is the thing where it's like, we do know Grayson has two strengths, being in the moment and finding that gap. And this establishes the gap, which is like, oh, he's not even like, he thinks of his own people at this way. Like he thinks of everyone beneath him is beneath him so far down that he's not even going to validate them. And not getting much further ahead, not knowing what's coming, this is my read on it, is that's going to be an exploitable section for Grayson to work in later. So
maybe onto something.
Maybe.
One last thing I want to say, I think there's a reason that this guy is on the edge of Combine space. There's a reason this guy isn't in the interior somewhere, you know, in some like heart of Combine place. This guy, they're like, we got to do something with this dude.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just the way he sees everybody else. That's how they see him. You know, he's reckless. He's you know, unhinged. So we don't want him around us. So let's go put him in a place that we don't care that much.
And
about.
It's somewhere he can be useful, right?
Yeah. You know,
who keeps hiring these psychopaths? You know, it's just like in the last book, Singh was insane. It's like, man, how's this keep happening?
Yeah.
Anyway, Kevlovic's like, sir, they seem to be rudderless. And then Nagano screams, they will cease. Duke Recall has personally ordered me to end the rebellion here. And you're like, incredible.
Huh.
Incredible.
He does have a type, it seems.
Baby. Red Duke, Red Hunter. He's in it. It's like all the players are here. It's literally like, this book, like, dude, William H. Keith was like, you know what? I'm going to take another run at it. Like, that's what he was like. He's like, you know what? I think I can do a better job. And he basically,
he even resets the, it's like beautiful. You know what, man? You did.
Yep.
This is a fuller, richer text. I'm having a good time.
One other thing, it's not really a surprise that the boy in red's here because it's kind of his zone. I won't get too far into that, but
it's the Green Hill zone.
He's in charge of this entire like aerospace. The fact that he's the guy at the next peg of the pecking order is really no surprise.
Oh, dude, but Recall's Dr. Robotnik and Grayson's totally Sonic.
That's a weird pairing, but I don't think you're entirely wrong.
Yeah, just replace chili dogs with mud.
Is there a chili dog thing with Sonic? I am not rich in Sonic lore, apparently.
Oh, well, you heard it here first, listeners. We've got another podcast coming.
I don't all make the Sonic me do books. That.
No.
Don't make me do that.
No.
No, thank you. I'm good, too.
And then, at the end here, we have this bit that Nagumo and Kevlovic, they're talking and, you know, he's giving them reports about what's going on and tells him Duke Recall has ordered him to end the rebellion, and he just restates his intention to take Verthandi in our fists and squeeze it until the last drop of blood. It's very dramatic. And then he's like, but I have another matter. We have detected a dropship coming in system, a Union class. Oh, so this is a Union class dropship, is now bound in system. For what purpose, my lord? And he's like, even though they're like, you know, it's possible that it's a mistake, which is exactly what they said, which is like, you know, ships are coming in and out, bringing supplies. It's like, you know, it really could just be some more supplies. Oh, and mech spares, it says as well. So they tell them they're bringing in supplies and mech spares. You know, Kevlovic's like, it could be a Lyrian raider. And he's like, yeah, it could be. You know, he's just like, we just got to keep an eye on it. He's like, we don't want to take our chances. We don't want it to be like supplies for the rebels. Or whatever, if it sets down, you got to go check it out, you know? And he's like, very well, my lord. And he salutes. Then he just like turns back to the window, just like it started, and like looks out at the jungle. It literally, the last sentence is, Governor General Masayoshi Nagumo found the faint jungle noises most pleasant. Our worst fears have kind of come true here. Like it wasn't, they were hoping that they could kind of slip in without even, no, literally like the top dog here is like, tells his most lethal killer, like, all right, you got to go check it out. So we're like, oh no, that didn't go as well as it could have, unfortunately. And Grayson doesn't even know yet, but we do.
With this, I took it a different way. Of this final statement is kind of almost the reassurance. This is kind of what Grayson and Tor were hoping for, of like, oh, he kind of mentions like, when they touch down, go check it out. And they were like, if we can touch down, we can just scurry and get out of there.
Right.
We can get, get it taken care of. So it's almost like, oh, okay, this is working out.
It's more of a dot your I's and cross your T's and less put everyone on alert.
Yeah. And so it opens with that idea of like, oh, it might be okay. But we're going to learn out the reality of that situation of, you know, maybe we just don't have one person making all the calls here in the next chapter.
Chapter 6. We're back on the Phobos. You know, it's burning down towards Verthandi. We're in the ship's lounge. We're here with Grayson. You know, we're having a staff meeting. You know, held once during each of the ship's standard 24-hour days. It takes a while to get down there. And Grayson's in there with the fighter pilots, the Chippewa fighters, Sue Ellen Klein and Jeffrey Sherman. And they are voicing some concerns. They are upset because, well, there's a variety of reasons it goes into. But one, because this is kind of a bad deal for them. Honestly, they're like, look, your ship, your drop ship is like not well, it doesn't have really any offensive power. Like when we're out there alone. And, you know, we can get shredded if we get in a bad spot. They're just like, we don't feel good about this. You know, we think this is a suicide mission because they were sole survivors of, they've already tangled with Combine fighters before. That's what they mentioned Severn before.
And their concerns are valid because they pretty much make an allusion to this literally what just happened to them to bring them onto Grayson's doorstep in the first place. You know, Grayson wants them to act as a fighter screen, right?
So a bailout unit.
Well,
get them some time to get some distance and get them set, and then essentially have the fighters regroup with them. And Sue Ellen asks the very surface level question that follows up that answer that Grayson gives them, or the request that Grayson gives them, of who bails us out if we're bailing you out?
And the answer is no one.
Yep.
But also, Grayson makes it very clear here, and it is true what he says. Having this fighter screen can mean that the chance of them getting onto the planet and not getting onto the planet. And so having the screen to intercept, because the dropship can't fight fighters. You know, now some dropships could ward off fighters, but it's pretty clear Grayson doesn't have a lot of armaments on this bad boy. And we see in this, in a coming chapter, that he has armaments literally painted on the side of the ship. And so this fighter screen, you know, he's like, you're probably not going to be able to get back on. I just need you to go out, intercept any incoming fighters. And, you know, he doesn't even want them to, like, get into an engagement. He just wants them to intercept and then bail out and try and, you know,
regroup with us on the planet.
Exactly. And because they're aerospace fighters, they can, you know, break through the atmosphere and do just that. It's they're upset, but this is literally, and I mean, big picture, this is literally what aerospace fighters do. This is your job. But aside from being close air support and reconnaissance, being like interceptors is like your job. Now, these heavy fighters might not be the best interceptors. They don't have a lot of speed, and they're not going to be able to get away from more nimble and quicker and lighter fighters, but they can probably dispatch them pretty easily. But
well,
I just wanted to set the scene up a little bit better as to what they're arguing over exactly, which is their job.
And I will say here, too, as they're going through that, as we kind of touched on all those points, I mean, that really does sum up this whole conversation that they are having. But, you know, we take every chance we can to dog on Grayson. But in this case, I do feel like Grayson is coming into this like, we're having this discussion now. Why? Because, like, we talked about the plan.
To get off the boat.
Yeah, you knew, we discussed the plan, we went through this, and now you're raising an alarm when we've committed. We're deep in this. There's no turning back at this point. We don't have a jump ship to go to. And, you know, you kind of have Sue Ellen and Jeffrey over here like, well, we didn't realize we were going to get such a raw end of the deal. And Grayson's trying to reiterate, like, this is the deal. Like, this is what we discussed.
It's always been the deal. It's never not been the deal.
And yes.
And he's right.
Yeah.
That's literally, this is your job as an aerospace fighter.
The unfortunate side of this is like, yeah, we don't have enough to bail you out. But what I'm telling you is not to.
But that was always going to be the case.
I'm not telling you to throw yourself, you know, into danger. I'm saying screen and get out.
Yep.
And and I feel like Grayson handles this really well. Because
I think so, too. As well as he can.
There's nothing else he could do. Somebody's going to get their feelings hurt from time to time. And I feel like this shows us that Grayson can handle that part.
I'm going to be honest with you. It just feels like they just don't want to do their job.
Yeah.
And it is dangerous. But that's why they're getting... Well, that's why they should be getting paid well.
Well, I mean, they got pockets full of IOUs for this. So, you know, they got 4,000 C-bills looking at them on the other end. So, yeah, I mean, there's a good case for why they're upset about this. And there's a good case for why Grayson has to shut it down. And I will say he shuts it down hard.
He does.
But does a good job of kind of deflecting that as well. Like, he shuts it down hard, leaves a very... Or I would say he leaves no room for questioning that shutdown and transition. So he actually showed some ability to lead here.
I do like that we see the bulk of the argument and then it just kind of fades out. And then it gives us kind of a narrator's voiceover with, you know, eventually they came to see it Grayson's way.
After he threatens, because he transitions it away from the atmosphere to like, man, that surface. We don't know what that surface is going to be like. It's going to be awfully tough to kind of move around on there. And then Sue Ellen immediately kind of like, how are you supposed to move mech through all that mud? And he's just like, I'm out. Yeah,
right. Because Aridin is here. Aridin, and it's Aridin tells him, you know, he's like, you got something to add, citizen? And he's like, I like, he says out loud, he's like, well, remember, you'll be meeting a man on our council named Erickson, who has a place on an island and stuff. You know, he basically, and then Grayson like looks at him like, he like cuts him a glance. He's like, maybe you shouldn't, he's like, don't be naming names.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, these guys might defect. Look at them. They're like about to walk. He's like, shut up, dude. He's saying, he's like, that might, you know, I was, there was like a little sentence there. It was funny. He does. So we do learn that they'll be meeting Erickson, who is a collaborator.
And I just want to say again, we see that Grayson's taking operational security very seriously again.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely, you know, we're ragging on him, but our boys come a long way since putting mud in his ears.
Yeah. You know, we've got a few feet away from Terrell Wan. So, and it's good to see that we are getting some growth here. Like, he is not staying as helpless as he was before in some respects. Yeah, he's still a little Grayson, but I don't feel like
he's helpless.
Yeah. I don't either. I feel like we have some of these moments
rough around the edges. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He like slams his palm on the tabletop, you know, and he's like, listen, and he like threatens to, like commandeer their ships. You know, he's like, I'll just take your stuff.
He throws out some like legalese that who knows if it's real or not. I feel like it's some real, like, in my head, I like the idea that Grayson just made it up and then they were like, you can do that. It's some real like playground, like, I'm going to take your shit and I'm allowed to because I'm the like hall monitor. Kind of like.
And so they like stomp off and then, but Ilsa Martinez is still there, right? They like stomp off and then you like you feel like they move out of frame and she's like sitting in a chair just like, you know, those two have a third option, right? And he's like, oh, and she calls him Major, because I do like, this comes up a few times where if someone who has the military rank of captain is on a ship, there can only be one captain. So the captain, the military captain is temporarily promoted.
Yeah, the rank is adjusted to avoid demoted or whatever. Double captains.
Right.
No.
A little bit of Keith's Navy's career is seeping through the pages here.
Yeah, but Grayson's like, oh, you know, what other option do they have? And she's like, dude, they could just sign on with the Combine. And he's like, oh, well, you know, they wouldn't do that because, and he brings up, you know, they're sole survivors of like a Combine attack and like her brother died. It was a whole thing. They hate him. So, but, and Ilsa's like, you know, they're sleeping together. And he's like, so? He's like, you are young, you know, two fighter jocks. You know, they're more concerned about each other. I don't call that a good situation, Major. She really like hits it hard like that. And he's like, whatever. Just get us through the blockade. I'll worry about my people. It's very, I love her.
I also love her. However, I think she's in the wrong here. I think Grayson's done his homework. He's read the room. He's read his crew. And I think he's making the right calls. I understand why she feels this way for as an outsider, somewhat of an outsider. Obviously she's, you know, a part of the gang, but as someone looking in at Grayson's command, however, I like that everyone's giving him shit and it's fun.
Oh yeah. Well, and there's also that part too, where Grayson has that one thing that we do see Grayson get over and over again. It's just like that nagging feeling of like something's wrong.
Yeah.
But he can't quite identify what it is yet. And he, you know, it rounds off that section as he's sitting there going like, we're going to get through this. You can see him just like sitting quietly and kind of pouting in his chair.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, in 10 hours, we're going to have our first encounter here, the enemy. And it rounds out this little section, not a chapter break, but a little section break here and Grayson already knew his unit was fatally flawed. And so he's detecting there's something in here he hasn't addressed, or he can't pick up where it's going to cause an issue, but he knows an issue exists.
He's looking for
it. But he's working with what he's got. So,
and she, it's clear, she thinks he's naive. Like, that's the big like flag she's raising. She's just like, you're just being naive. But I actually, I think he's doing everything he can. Even from what you were just saying, he knows there's something going on.
He just doesn't know the way to... He doesn't have the tact yet to be able to handle it and identify and vocalize the issue.
And this little section here, kind of, because there's like a little break, but it tells you they do, on their radar, they have detected that there is something coming, right? There are drop ships in the area and they're on a course. It's going to take like 10 hours, but, you know, it's like, so they are locked in. Nothing has stopped them now. They're going to come into contact with, you know, Kharitan forces on their way to the planet. It looks like they're committed now. And then there's a little bit where a jump ship like jumps in at the like nadir point, like shoots like a signal, like communication, microwave energy. And so it like transmits something down to the surface of the planet. And, you know, it's mission complete. The courier vessel began preparations return. The Galatean spy's report would reach for Thandi in less than 11 minutes. So this is that spy, right? That dude back on Galatea. He must have sent a jump ship to go in and send him a little message. Tell him that the Great Death Legion was coming. So things are not going well.
No, and we have that timeline of like, oh, he's expecting to encounter resistance in 10 hours, and we got a message arriving in 11 minutes. So they're not lined up in Grayson's favor here.
No, the cards are stacking up against him.
Yep.
And then this chapter isn't even over. No, it just keeps going. Then we cut to like the fleet admiral, the Combine, Isuru Kodo, and he's there, and there's like a Captain Powell. You know, so there's like the admiral and the guy. And this is the whole scene. Captain Powell is like trying to tell the admiral like, hey, there's something going on. Like this is like really suspicious and like we should do something about it. Like the readings of the dropship coming in. And he's just like stonewalling her, right? This is that whole scene.
If we ever get to talk to or interview William H. Keith, I'm going to ask him about this interaction, because I think that this lady is a self-insert for Keith, because I know this frustration.
That or at least a relayed story of reality here, because it does. I agree. I read this and I felt like this was something that he alluded to all throughout Decision at Thunder Rift. There were a lot of little interactions like this of somebody just going like, what about this? And then somebody going, it's really not our concern. And then they followed the order to the T. And this is kind of our first interaction of it, where somebody's coming up and saying like, here's the problem, here's a hair raiser, I followed this down. Somebody was very competent. When we are listening to Powell here, there's a competency there,
right?
That is saying, I've seen
Powell's data. She's done the math about the drop. She's like, I've compared the drive flares and like the weight and stuff, and it just doesn't match up. She's like, she brings him like the math. And he's like, whatever, I'm surrounded by idiots. Like, it's very frustrating.
It feels,
because she's right.
She is right. And, we know, obviously, she's right. But it just feels like something he's encountered in the Navy. I know I've encountered similar situations. And the guy's just like, no.
Well, it's the frustration of a highly competent person serving under somebody less competent. And that sees through this.
It doesn't even seem like it's so much competency. Obviously, it is somewhat competency, but it's almost this guy above is politically motivated.
Yeah.
Where the other person's trying to do their job.
Yeah,
and
those things don't see eye to eye here at all.
But she's going to do something about it.
Oh, yeah. They're on the moon, by the way. They're on a moon base. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm. There's just some listening post, some outpost.
Yeah. So then she stomps away, frustrated. And then, like, a young lieutenant hands her, like, a message. It's like, oh, we received a priority message from a courier. And you're like, oh, this must be. And she, like, takes the page and, like, reads it. And she's like, yes, I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. But then she's like, if I take this to the admiral, like one, he might still just, he's like useless to me, and he might even take it and then just take credit for it. And she's like, but I can't jump the chain of command because then I would get in trouble. She's like, I just got to do it myself. What if I signaled a nearby patrol to go check it out? That's kind of within my jurisdiction, you know, and tell them. She decides to take matters into her own hands and send her own dudes after it. This chapter is just a series of escalating.
Yeah.
It just keeps getting worse. You're like, man, this is going really poorly.
Which is really fun too, because Keith does such a good job setting up those escalations, and because all of them are outside the knowledge of Grayson.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, oh, Grayson's weak point is always competent people, and you were handed a great competent setup for this. Oh, somebody that even understands how to, you know, work around the gray zones of duty to make sure that she can get what she wants done without getting in trouble for doing so.
However, I have another read on this, which is inevitably we're dealing with a flawed machine here.
Yeah.
We're seeing, like, while it's also terrifying, there's a lot of tension being built up about, like, is Grayson going to make it? But we're also seeing, if Grayson can see these gaps in the armor and stick his knife in there, he's going to have a good chance. And that's Grayson shit, right?
Yeah, that's
classic
his shit.
Grayson. Yeah. Like, Grayson does good at this.
Grayson so I think lives because he finds little gaps of where people are looking. He finds those rigid structures and basically just like sidesteps it just enough that he doesn't take a fatal wound for it.
And so that was it. I just
and it at that point it does feel like you're about to hit the end of this chapter, but wait, there's more.
No, there's one last scene, which is, you know, Grayson's on the bridge, they're on the dropship, it's you know, burning in towards the planet, and he's up there with Martinez, and they're looking over on the radar, the nav console screen. They see the those fighter escorts. You know, they're like, "Oh, we got new radar readings. They're coming in." And you know, Martinez is like, "Escorts, I'd say, probably not shaping for an attack pass." They get an incoming message. I mean, this is all going to plan. You know, they have a whole script they worked out. You know, Grayson tells them he's an inbound. You know.
Yeah, they pick up that they have the old code.
The fighters hail him. Yeah, the fighters hail him. They tell him that they're, you know, in the service of Recall, which is funny. You have, you know, entered their territory. They demand they identify himself. And, you know, he picks up the, you know, Grayson, like, I feel like he looks over at Martinez and, like, nods and, like, picks up the microphone and, like, "This is dropship Lee Tao inbound to Verthandi." He does, they have a whole little script there. Like they, you know, just like they rehearsed, he tries his best to sound very confident.
And play dumb.
You know, we learned that they're Shylons. They're Shylons, Jerry.
Yes.
Canted. Twin fin wing shapes. Shylons are cool.
Shylons are cool.
Shylons are cool. And they are effective. And they would shred this dropship easily if they got within range. And unfortunately, the fighters, they fail their persuasion check. And they're like, "Your codes are obsolete. We got to come in for a pass." Grayson's like, "All right, well, if you got to do it." And they're just like, "Make no attempt to alter. Keep on going." So they're coming in. They're coming in. He like hangs up the phone. Martinez like looks up at him, arches an eyebrow like, "Oh, a little touchy."
It's some real like, I feel like the energy in the room, some real Hunt for the Red October. Everyone's like sweating, you know, like.
It's like a submarine movie. Yeah.
Well.
I just see Grayson, though, as being like, "No, I talked to him. It's good." Like, everybody else is like, "I don't think so."
I will say, so these Shylones, they're cool ships. The Chippewas outclass them, though. I think that it's, don't get me wrong, they'd give them a run for their money, but the Chippewas, like, they have a much better armament, and there's a good chance that they could win those bouts.
Yeah, well, but Grayson talked to him, so we won't even have to get to that.
We have some more gray time. He does. There's like a moment of reflection where one, he's like talking about, you know, there's a little insert here where he's like, you know, it's frustrating being like a, you know, being like a ground-based warrior in like an air battle or like a space battle, because like they feel especially, you know, out of, you know, it's like outside of their control, and how like, how scary it is. It is scary because all you can really do is watch. But yeah, he's on the bridge. He's like, "Man, I really hope I didn't just kill us all. You know, this is what I trained for, to lead men and women into battle." But he felt the agony of fear. He might have made his last biggest mistake. So it's go time. Not only that, yeah, and then the radar pings again, and it's like, "Oh, also in for the further distance, don't, you know, on top of that, we also got some more fighters and dropships coming." So, you know, and really, what is it? The chapter just ends with, you know, moment by moment, the Phobos was being boxed in by forces she couldn't outrun and can never hope to overcome. And that's true. They're getting boxed in. It's a bad scene.
Yeah, I mean, this is something where we had all that set up by Keith through these last couple chapters about, like, here's the plan, here's its fail points, and then one by one, like, addressing how those fail points actually failed this time, kind of culminating into this, where it's like, oh, this is now escalated into technically the worst case scenario for them, that they are now being completely surrounded and the jig is up, almost completely up.
From a meta perspective, you know, strictly the writing, like I feel like Keith is really in his element here. Like this is so much more competent than Decision at Thunder Rift, which was admittedly his first book. And as you said, he's set all of this up. He's done his due diligence.
Yeah.
He's laid out the dominoes.
Yeah. And took his time knocking over each one into that rhythm to where we're here now. And then you go, well, what happens when the last one falls there? And that's going to be an answer we're going to get here in the next chapter.
Chapter 7. We're back with General Nagumo, and he's on the horn. He's on the phone with, the comm screen. There's actually a bit of a time delay. He has this whole bit here where he's mad that the weird lag is making it so he can't cut him off as effectively because he's just such a dick.
Yeah, what an asshole.
It's so funny. Yeah. But the Admiral is now communicating that there's a situation and that they've sent stuff to intercept. You know, he's like, don't worry about it. It's totally routine. And Nagumo's like, it's not routine. At least you had the wherewithal to send a patrol out to check on it. And you're like, whoa, you know, somebody's getting a promotion or killed. I don't know. But he's like, yes, my lord. And so Nagumo tells him, look, just don't let him get any closer. Take care of the problem, But Nagumo now knows that something's going on, as he suspected that there might be something fishy going on. He's made, there's scrambling fighters, there's drop ships. He's still like, we should have got them earlier. We actually let them get a little too close, honestly. But he's like, yeah, my admiral's just an idiot. He hates everyone. He thinks that everyone who works for him is just like the stupidest person. How long until visual contact is made? And he's like, only a few minutes, we're like pretty close now. And he's like, everyone on full alert. All right. And then he gets a transmission come through. What is that thing? And They have camera feed, right, of the dropship. They say the radar scan, as makes it out to be a Union class, but the pilot's checking it out, right? And they're like, that's not a Union class, I don't know, something doesn't seem right. So the fighters are closing in again. Nagano, he's watching everything going down. He's kind of stressing out about it. He thinks everyone's an idiot. And then he receives a transmission. Nothing, just a, what's going on? No, we just have a courier message. What is it? It's nothing. Read it to me now. It's very funny. It's the report from the agent on Galatea. Report, mercenary unit, probably employ of rebels en route to Verthandi. And then, of course, Nagumo's like, yes, I knew it. It is a trick. Attack. Relay command, my authority. Attack. And then, the fighters are like already on the way. It's kind of
Redundant.
Emergency. So now everyone's in full scramble, flight 19 to base ship. Intruder is hostile. What's happening? And so, right. It's going completely out of control. And what's he doing? The intruder is accelerating. So someone just hits, Martinez just slams the throttle. And
woman can read her own.
Nagano's just get me Colonel Kevlavik. He's just like mercenaries.
This shit rules.
Yeah. And I kind of like how, we had just talked about that scene about the competent person doing what they needed to do. And the only reason they have anything set up for this is that the competent person made a move.
Yep.
And you have this whole scene with Kodo in there, with his flop sweat rag that he's just wiping his face down and his head down with the whole time as he's reporting his failure to Nagumo. And Nagumo is still through this whole way. Is treating it like it's really not that out of the ordinary. He's just like, you're just a shit for not catching it. Like, now we're just going to deal with it. And then, as timing couldn't be worse for Grayson that message come through. And it's almost like that self-realization of failure point for Nagumo, but he very easily just lies to himself and puts the blame on everybody else.
It's all ego.
Yeah.
It's all egos rubbing against each other.
Yeah. And it's like, well, now we need to do it. But then everybody that was actually taking care of the issue was already moving it.
Yeah.
So, once again, just more of that little, what we were talking about, that gap in the armor is just getting a little stronger.
Yeah.
However, it's a very small gap for Grayson to see right now.
As I don't know that he does see it.
No, you
know,
this
is all dramatic irony. However, that full throttle dropship, it's going to be hard. You know, the way this all works, the sci-fi math, it's going to be hard pressed for them to intercept them at this point, except for those fighters that have already been dispatched. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, and then it kind of picks right up from Grayson's point of view from here.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It immediately cuts back up to Grayson and Martinez on the bridge. We see what just happened from their perspective, which is, you know, they hear the alarms go off because they're intercepting the comms. They know that the jig is up. And so Grayson tells her that she can open fire, and she slices one of the Shylons with like the laser from the dropship. It's not, you know, it doesn't have a lot of weapons, but it has some weapons. So it does take out one of the Shylons, and that's why the transmission got cut. And they're like, it's hostile, it's hostile, it turns out. And then you see her like slam the throttle and like put it in, you know, standby for high G maneuvers. You know, she puts it at 4 Gs, dude. Brutal. And she like, oh, missiles blossom from the Phobos missile bays, struck the accelerating fighter. So she shoots missiles and lasers the Shylons. It's true. The dropship totally takes out the Shylons, which is pretty cool.
And it does appear they have some armaments.
Yes, just enough for right now. And, you know, the immediate threat due to quick acting, which is, you know, our Grayson specialty dish. Like his dish of the day is always...
Hold up. Let's not give Grayson too much credit here. This is...
Oh, with the skill of the pilot. I'm just saying Grayson could have said, let's see if we can get out of this.
Totally.
Right. And he just said, nope. Fire.
They've got
like,
it. Yep.
That person, because they...
Fair enough.
I like it, that little detail.
He didn't get in the way.
Yeah. Well, the little detail when they have the first encountering the pilots, they mention that the comms are encrypted. And because they don't have the codes, they can't understand what they're saying.
Right.
But then Grayson picks up. He's like, there's no mistaking. That guy got worked up. Jigs up. Martinez, do your thing.
Yep.
And doesn't get in the way.
Oh, yeah.
He lets Martinez do it. Martinez deals with the two most immediate threats. Not all of them, but the two most immediate. And that gives him a second of breathing room.
The knife here is the competence.
Yep.
Yes. So they cut the ship's boost, and that Leopard class dropship is closing in, right, with that pair of fighters. So they're almost here too. They come in right behind the other pair of fighters, and like the Leopard's already cutting in, and they like it. It opens fire on the Phobos. Then it is funny. You know, there's that whole paragraph. It like as soon as it opens fire, there's this whole paragraph about explaining that because the succession wars and lost tech and stuff, that like targeting systems suck. He does take a moment to be like, now remember, you would think that they would have figured this out by now and stuff wouldn't miss, but it totally does because their tech sucks too. I was like, oh, okay. That checks out. And then immediately it's like the first enemy volley missed. It's like he had to get in front of it. I know he cuts in with a whole paragraph about like, you're like, come on, why would a spaceship miss? And it's like, oh, it's because they suck. It's like, oh, okay. I buy it. You earned it.
Just to tack on to it, most weapon systems are going to be dumbfire, right? As in you put a reticle over something and then the gun shoots where the reticle is, like everything except for the semi-guided missiles that are SRMs and LRMs. And it's only semi-guided.
Yeah,
it's
not. You still have to do lead times and things like that. And I would say I would almost knock this little interruption in the scene because we did so many times in the first book where it was like we got into the middle of tension and then we get this long explanation. He keeps this one relatively short, and I think
it plays humorously.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't knock this one.
It's kind of funny
because right after it, he follows it up with a very simple sentence of the first enemy we all even missed, and it's just like, okay, you played it off. Like,
it feels
I like that
very Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah,
like it's some real like, and we set it up, and then whack.
Yep.
Yeah,
they make their pass right because they make a pass. They do buy them. They're like, all right, well, they're gonna come back around. You know, they're just going to work us. What is it? Grayson, like, swims over to the console and, like, Aridin is there, like, Devik Aridin. And he's like, I'm going to get sick. Like, what do you want me to do?
He's like, well, not get sick.
Yeah. You know, what's happening now? What's the captain doing? And Grayson, like, looks over at like, Martinez, and he's like, we're dropping the pups to Chippewa fighters. Yeah, let's go. We're probably under observation, so.
Probably.
The enemy dropship? So much for the non-existent. Yeah, he, and then like Aridin's like, what about the enemy dropship I heard them talking about? And Grayson like looks over like, we'll have to wait and see. So much for the non-existent blockade, citizen. You know, I don't understand. We've been away. Will we get through? We'll find out. And yeah, so here we go. They're gonna drop the Chippewas. It's time to see if those fighter pilots were right. I wonder. But the yeah, and the chapter ends with when the Combine ships emerged again from behind the planet. They would strike.
Yep.
William H. Keith does a. You know, he sets all this up and it's like, it's almost like this, you don't get the Star Wars style fight here. You get this, like, it's this long, like looming, you know, like the dropships like arcing over the planet and there's another one you can see in the distance. It's all like, you know, the ranges are all like, you know, long and like the small fighters are moving in and out, but they're like using like the gravity wells to like, to like increase speed and decrease speed, you know, it's it. Like I said, it's very. If it's anything, it's more like almost like Battlestar Galactica.
It's cool,
you know.
I like love all this. I love the space combat totally. And BattleTech. It's actually like pretty
cool.
I
agree, and I wish we got more of it. We do. Okay, so we do. We do get more.
And you know what? We'll talk about it when we get there.
We will. Okay. Okay. I'm
in
sorry.
The future.
In the future. Yes.
But. No, and I will say here, I actually really like the way Keith drags this out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because he very could have easily like have wrapped up this combat in this chapter. We have seen his fast-paced combat before, and it normally is more about what the combat was over, and that's the meaning behind it. It wasn't the combat itself. And this one feels like this is about the combat itself. So he takes that time. He draws it out. We get that quick, okay, bam, bam, fighters are gone. But then it's right back to like, but we're not out of the danger. We've got a dropship on intercept. We've got two fighters that are going to come. And he keeps that tension up by slowing that pace and saying like, oh, we're going to get that more of like, it's going to have a pass feel to it and less of a like, you're getting lost in the like, where totally. Are these ships at? You can clearly follow along on this track and you're keeping by slowing it down. You see where everything is in the scene.
And if you're thinking ahead, right, it's like, well, even if Grayson makes it through this, they already, the jig's up.
Yep.
They're going to scramble forces to intercept him on the, like, you know, it's set up that there's tension through and through.
Yeah. And he makes full use of this, especially what we're going to talk about here in the next coming chapter. We'll see what more is in store for us of Mercenary Star next week. So make sure to read up.
And that'll do it. This has been another episode of Mechs and Men. I'm Kanan Hill. Joined as usual by Brent and Aaron, my two good friends. And remember, please write in. The email is advice@heat.management. You know, that'll be fun. And, you know, we wanted to thank, as always, Catalyst Games for being such worthy stewards and caretakers to this universe, to this intellectual property that we love so dearly. And, you know, to the community, to all you guys, of course, right? It's just a bunch of people who just like this stuff. We just love this stuff. And we just love talking about it. But yeah, of Mechs and Men, thank you so much. We will see you next time.